Deep Leaf Audio presents The Historical Illuminatus Chronicles, Volume 1, The Earth Will Shake, by Robert Anton Wilson, read by Scott Crisp. Part 1, The Fool. During their stay in France, the Jacobites had been deeply involved in the dissemination of Freemasonry. They established more direct connections between Freemasonry and the various activities, alchemy, Kabbalism, and Hermetic thought, for instance, that were regarded as Rosicrucian. Michael Bagent, Richard Lee, and Henry Lincoln. Holy blood, holy grail. What strikes the stranger most about Naples is the common occurrence of assassination. Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, Letters from Italy, 1792. Sigismundo Cellini was lost in a dark forest with a red Indian, seeking the supreme Wakan. At the same time, with another part of his mind, he was very aware of everything going on around him in the Cathedral of San Francesco di Paola on this Easter Sunday morning. The trick about getting up early from Mass, Uncle Pietro always said, was to enter into deep meditation, total empty-headedness, so that the mystery of the sacrament could wash over you gently, but not get so relaxed that the people in the adjoining pews could hear you snore. In that deep passivity, Sigismundo was watching the priest prepare for the Holy Communion, and still listening to the Indian talking about the Wakan, whatever that was, and not letting his head sink forward to indicate he was half-dreaming, and almost noticing the four strangers in black who were approaching the Malatesta pew. "For this is my body," the priest intoned solemnly in Latin. The Latin was similar to the Italian that everybody spoke, and yet it wasn't Italian, but Italian had once been Latin. Somewhere back in time, maybe 600 or 700 years ago, Neapolitans had been speaking something that was half Latin and half Italian, an in-between language. "And this is my blood." Did they know back then that they were speaking a halfway language? And now that the bread and wine were the body and blood of Christ, the mystical presence, Sigismundo found himself wondering about the exact point in time, the instant T in the calculus, when it was half bread and half Christ, the way language was once half Latin and half Italian. And then he saw that the four strangers had taken daggers out of their cloaks and were moving in much faster. He, the boy Sigismundo, came fully awake, thinking it was like one of the overly detailed frescoes of Filippo Lippi. Too much rapid action, too many moving characters, too much color and violence for the mind to comprehend. For the four dark men were all stabbing Uncle Leonardo Malatesta at once, and above them, in perspective, was the priest in his gold and blue robe. And there was he, Sigismundo Cellini, off to the right corner of the Malatesta pew, because the Cellini pew was too crowded. And there, in the new center of everybody's attention, was Uncle Leonardo looking pop-eyed, like a cuckold in a commedia, the boy thought, as if he himself could not believe what was happening as the strangers plunged their daggers into his belly again and again. And Aunt Gina was falling on top of Sigismundo, the prettiest woman in Napoli, everybody said, screaming with red blood splotching her blue skirts. Then it all seemed to whirl around him for a moment, language changing from Latin to Italian, half-dream becoming awful reality, wheat changing into bread, bread changing into Christ, wheat then becoming flesh, the symbolic sacrifice of Christ becoming the real sacrifice of Uncle Leonardo. He even thought in shame that he was about to retch, because the blood was on him now, too, and the priest had been calling for God's blood, the sacrament had become a devil's sabbat, and instead of doing anything, he was frozen, thinking that Father Ratti at school had explained that the bread was still Christ, even if it fell to the floor and was covered with dust and dirt and muck. And blood, he wondered? Because all physical appearance was accident, and the spiritual essence remained the same, it was still God, whatever the physicality of the accident. You had to understand those terms to pass the final examination in religious knowledge. So, in his vertigo, he thought crazily, "We have come here to eat flesh and drink blood." But then he knew he would not retch. "I am a Cellini, and even a Malatesta." but everybody and his brother and a few of their cousins seemed to be pushing and running now, some trying to flee and some attempting to get to the scene of the atrocity to help Uncle Leonardo. And the priest was still standing as if frozen, looking back over his shoulder absurdly, almost like a man who suspects a hole in the seat of his breeches, the host high above his head, the mystical presence of God looking down on the way men butcher men in this year of our Lord, 1764. And there he was, the boy Sigismundo, trying to rise, trying to push past Mama and Aunt Gina to help Uncle Leonardo, but still seeing it as a fresco, a scene painted by Lippi or Angelico, unchanging like the arrow in Zeno's paradox, not able to move, whispering, "I am not a coward," although nobody was listening to him, seeking perhaps to explain to himself why he was immobilized. And then the murderers retreated all at once, the four of them like a staged tableau in an opera by Vivaldi, four swarthy southerners in plain black wool, moving outward toward the four corners of the church and leaving Uncle Leonardo suddenly alone in the gold-embroidered brocade of the Malatestas, even more like a painting, their black against his bright colors, and he was able to move then, Sigismundo, leaping the pew to charge at the nearest assassin and immediately getting a good grip on the weapon arm, the arm that could kill, trying to swing the swine around to land a punch in his face and surprised at how easy it was, the Siciliano spinning lightly, quickly, almost like a child's top, just the way Giancarlo Tannone, master of fencing, said a man should spin if you exerted a push and a pull in that way. And then it was not what the boy had planned, because before he could land a punch, he felt the stinging and the wetness and knew he had been stabbed himself. It was impossible. He was holding the dirty hound's dagger arm. And he was still trying to understand, still holding the dagger arm, when he felt the second stinging slash and realized the Siciliano had caught him with the oldest trick in the book. The filthy foul dog's get had a second dagger in his left hand. God curse him and plague the town he was born in. And as he lost his grip, not knowing if he was slashed on an artery, the boy Sigismundo stared directly into the eyes of the assassin, eyes with a strange glint of violet swimming in the black, and saw that which he could not, would not, believe. The Siciliano did not want to kill him. No, more. The assassin, who was a youth, only a few years older than Sigismundo himself, was determined and resolved not to kill him, as if he had sworn it on his mother's grave at a full moon, and perhaps even spit over his shoulder. Sigismundo was being preserved for something else. You could read that much in a man's eyes sometimes, Uncle Pietro claimed. It was the witch power, and it came to everybody, not just the Strege, at special moments of excitement. If you were open to it, Uncle Pietro said, it would tell you what your opponent in a fight was going to do next. But then Sigismundo stumbled, the whole church spinning weirdly for a moment, because he was nauseated by so much of his own blood spurting from his arm, like life itself leaving him in a visible crimson rush, and the assassin tore loose and fled. Sigismundo thought, they train them young in Sicily, and then... His face was familiar, but damn my eyes if I know where I ever saw him before. And then he allowed himself to think a wry joke. God Almighty, in the morning, maybe he allows himself only one murder on an Easter Sunday. It may be his kind of piety. Maybe he abstains from deflowering virgins on St. Gennaro's feast day and doesn't rob the blind and halt during Lent. Because being spared by such a creature, a fully trained professional killer, was like opening a door in your own house and finding yourself in Baghdad or Cathay. It was a violation of nature. The only explanation of such a monstrosity was grisly to contemplate. It could be that old vicious Sicilian game, like sticking a dagger into your pillow at night, right next to your throat. The message was that you had been spared this time, but you had to find out what they wanted, or you would not be spared the next time. But maybe he was letting his imagination run away with him. The assassin was young. Maybe he, curse his violet eyes, just had a moment of panic. Or maybe Chirino Maldonado, the only one who could be behind this, had paid for only one murder. Assassination must be like any other profession, Sigismundo thought. You don't get rich giving two for the price of one.
Oh, my God, I detest all my sins, Uncle Leonardo was saying, gagging on his own blood, trying to make an act of contrition. But then he was falling at last, his eyes shiny and jewel-like and empty. And then he hit the floor with a crash that made the boy realize what the phrase dead weight means.
There seemed to be blood everywhere, on everything. Sigismundo dry-retched once and then started tearing his sleeve to make a tourniquet for his arm. He had always thought men died nobly, making heroic speeches. This had been as glorious and operatic as the time Sigismundo saw the cook pulling out the intestines as she cleaned a chicken. But then what happened next was just ordinary life again, with time moving in a regular and normal manner, without those jumps and freezes, and maybe he was still a little dizzy even though the slashes on his arm seemed superficial. And Uncle Pietro had taken command of everything just as he always did. Sigismundo's father, Guido Celline, was sputtering and shouting without anybody paying attention, while Pietro spoke quietly and firmly. At such times, Sigismundo knew, everybody did what Uncle Pietro expected, simply because he, Pietro Malatesta, could not imagine or would not allow himself even to suspect that anyone would have the brazen, unmitigated stupidity to contradict his orders. So there he was, the boy Sigismundo Celline, who was the most brilliant young musician in all Italy since Antonio Vivaldi, in the estimation of the only two people whose opinions mattered, himself and Uncle Pietro, having learned in only a few minutes that people do not die in real life the way they do in operas. And it was off across the Via di Roma to the barber surgeons for him, Uncle Pietro dragging him as fast as they both could trot, and a trail of blood dripping from his arm behind them because the tourniquet was not properly made and was now starting to flap loose, sounding like a bat's wings in a dark room. And then the church bells started, clanging from one end of Napoli to the other. Communion services were over everywhere, except in San Francesco di Paola, where they were probably still mopping up the blood. They are commemorating the resurrection, Sigismundo thought. They are not doing it to mock our grief. I must not let myself think the chimes are the sounds of a thousand demons pounding on the anvils of hell to celebrate this latest atrocity against God and man. He was unable to believe still that the assassins, even if Sicilians and thus by definition children of the devil, had actually struck at the very moment the sacrament was being consecrated, when the mystical presence of Christ was entering the church, and on a high holy day when everybody was attending Mass to thank God for ending the recent typhus epidemic. It was as if they wanted to show Christ, to his very face, that they despised religion itself as well as human life, as if they were demons incarnate. Dante put the murders in a different bolge, depending on the horribleness of the crime. At the very bottom of hell, caina tende, were those who treacherously killed their friends or relatives. There should be a deeper pit, Sigismundo thought, for those who kill in church on Easter to mock the mercy of God. But it was a surprise to learn that he was a hero already, the legend having preceded him across the Via di Roma to Portinari's shop here on Via Cristoforo Colombo, where all the boys in Napoli, it seemed, had gathered to watch in awe as the fresh bandage was professionally applied. They were all trying to tell each other what he had done and were asking him for more details, one beardless and pimply face shouting to be heard over another, Uncle Pietro and the barber surgeon being the only adults there, and all so excited they could not even wait for answers to their own questions, and did not notice that Sigismundo was trying to ask a question of his own, until finally he had to roar above all of them to be heard.
Did the fatherless ones get away?
And when he received the bitter answer that he already expected, he guarded his face very closely, because Uncle Pietro was there and he knew, although he had had the white sticky evidence of his manhood for over a year now, that he was still a boy to the family. A boy. A noisy nuisance, slightly better than a girl, of course, but not to be trusted with grown-up men's business.
Professionals? The barber surgeon, Signor Portinari, who had lost two children to the typhus, asked.
The one this young idiot wrestled with had another dagger in his left hand, Uncle Pietro replied, cold as a herring, holding it all in.
Ah,
Signor Portinari said. He repeated it significantly, as if he had not expected it.
Professionals.
He was always a bit slow and had about a half-inch more forehead than a gorilla. Then he asked, abruptly, tightening the bandage painfully, Siciliani?
They looked it, Uncle Pietro said.
Ah, old Portinari said thoughtfully, like a mathematician solving an equation.
Professionals.
And Sigismundo knew, everybody in Napoli knew, what Siciliani professionals meant. Uncle Pietro had said many times it was a known fact that the Siciliani were the oldest and most intractable people on earth, older than the Roman Empire and the Caesars, older even than the Etruscans or Minoans, so old that their ways and ideas were incomprehensible to anyone but the devil himself. If a Siciliano was determined enough, everybody believed it, he would kill you even if it meant his own death, which was a species of honor Neapolitans could understand. But the mad Sicilians went further, much further. They would kill you if their whole family had to die for it, or their whole town, or even Sicily itself. It was as if, Uncle Pietro said, they had decided, knowing they were a minority on earth, that the only way to survive was not to care about survival, to be so crazy mean that nobody would challenge them, like the bee, Uncle Pietro said, who will die in order to sting you, just to be sure nobody ever lost respect for the testicles of bees. That was why the Neapolitans had a joke, that there were four kinds of sons of you-knows. The ordinary everyday son of a you-know, who was mean only if you came between him and his prophets. And the revolving son of a you-know, who was always a son of a you-know no matter when you encountered him. And the son of you-know on wheels who devoured ordinary and revolving son of you-knows for breakfast and chewed up a consecrated bishop for lunch. And finally, the transcendental Sicilian son of a you-know, who was like the platonic ideal to which all other son of you-knows could only aspire. If you want to prove your bravery, Uncle Pietro said, try taking food from a feeding tiger or kick a lion in the testes, but don't. If you want your grandchildren's grandchildren's second cousin's gardener to walk the streets without looking over his shoulder all the time, don't, for Jesus' sake, get into a feud with the fornicating Siciliani. Because Sicily itself and every last Sicilian could be wiped off the face of the earth, extinguished, erased, and every Sicilian would agree to it, stubborn as a mule, if it were necessary to go that far, just to make sure nobody anywhere ever lost respect for the Sicilians. Uncle Pietro said, a master swindler could cheat an Armenian rug merchant once in a million times, and a demon from hell might frighten a Spaniard once in a million million times, but not even God himself, with the 12 apostles to help him, could stop a fully resolved Siciliano without first killing him, and then methodically killing his brothers, and then his cousins and uncles, and next his second cousins and great-uncles, and of course his women cousins, and any toddling infant old enough to throw a rock, and so on forever, but until God himself killed the last Sicilian great-great-grandfather, still able to totter weakly on his crutches and hawk to spit, it would keep coming against him, ineluctable as he himself, because that was the way Sicily had survived the Greeks, and the Sulas, and Belisarius, and the Normans, and the Hohenstaufens, and everybody and everything thrown against them in southern Italy in general since time itself began.
Nobody in Napoli ever lost respect for the Sicilians, and nobody in Roma either. Even the Pope, Uncle Pietro said, prayed every night that he hadn't inadvertently offended a Sicilian. Some claim that people were afraid of Sicilians even as far away as Rimini or Firenze, or even in Spain where the divine Scarlatti had gone, or far away over the Alps in Bavaria, where the women were all you-knows and the men were heretics and wizards. So it was back across Napoli, the bay gleaming like silver and tin and ruddy copper in the morning sun, the bay that people from Venezia and even England came thousands of miles to gawk pop-eyed at, and, having gawked and popped their eyes, went home to tell their envious neighbors what a lucky thing it was to be a Neapolitan, Uncle Pietro said.
And across the Palazzo Reale, and past the golden Teatro San Carlo where he, the boy Sigismundo, had received the part of his education that mattered most, having encountered there Vivaldi and Jomelli and Pergolesi, although it was on his own that he had discovered Scarlatti and Telemann.
It, the Golden Teatro, was the only good thing that fat Bourbon hog Don Carlos had ever done for Napoli, Uncle Pietro said once, in a very low voice, of course. But what could you expect of a hell-spawned half-French Spaniard, except that he would give the Neapolitans a golden wedding cake of an opera house, named after his patron saint, no less, to advertise his good taste to all posterity, and then bugger the Neapolitans every way a conniving half-Spanish Frenchman could think of. The arm was hurting now, with sharp little throbs of pain, like an aching tooth beginning to abscess. Those fatherless ones, as you called them, and where does a boy your age learn such language? Uncle Pietro was chattering, ignoring the teatro, trying to shake off his own furies. Those motherless and fatherless things, those sons of poxy half-a-lire whores, by goats and hounds and Barbary apes, to be precise, those bastards in black who murdered my brother, damn them to hellfire for a million eternities, are probably out of Napoli by now. Real professionals, as old Portinari was saying, and very well trained. May their wives abort and their mothers go blind, and it might be a proud family tradition. Their grandfathers' grandfathers could have done similar work for the Borgias. But why? Why? Pietro stopped in his tracks on the street and glared at the boy. What else is Napoli, or for that matter Portici or Resina, or this whole lower peninsula famous for, if not for the high quality and superabundant quantity of our professional belly-stabbers and widow-makers? We are the ornament and envy of the ne plus ultra of the world, lad. Let infidel Turks brag of their riches and harems, or the French of their dramatists and philosophers. We have the most accomplished knife artists here. That we should live in this madhouse of Napoli and call ourselves men, it is, you see, Siggy, a joke. Human beings. God's own image. Rational animals, Aristotle says. Rational. And then he was weeping, Uncle Pietro, the most crafty and, some said, coldest man in Naples, weeping unashamedly on the public street. I teased him, he said, leaning on the boy's shoulder. When we were children, I teased him, the little shrimp, and I bullied him. God forgive me. God forgive us all. We are such perfect fools. His whole body shaken with spasms for a moment. Uncle, the boy said, embarrassed and frightened. I know, but it was all a joke, you see, Pietro Malatesta protested, more to God, perhaps, than to the boy. That when the typhus goes away and all seems safe again, murder falls on us like a thunderbolt from the skies. An hour ago he was just one of my brothers, not the smartest one at all. The very last one, in fact, that I would trust with important financial matters. And then they kill him, and I realize what I always should have honored in him, that he was the kindest of us, the best Christian, the best husband, the best father, the best man. I was too busy making money to notice little things like that. We are all too busy. Jesus, Jesus, Jesus. And then Pietro Malatesta was walking erect again, his face calm and closed once more, except for dark, suffering eyes. Those Malatesta eyes that people said were like a falcon's, so cold that their cleverness was frightening, so clever that their coldness was itself a warning. And when they got home, everybody was there, all the Cellines and Malatestas in Napoli, and Aunt Gina kept crying and crying. The men were talking very quietly to each other, always lowering their voices still further when Sigismundo came near, or any of the other children either, so it was obvious. He was, at 14, still a boy. They would not include him in on it. He would have to start a separate, private vendetta. But what was insufferable was that not once, all through the afternoon of mourning and whispering and on into twilight, did anybody mention the name until he wanted to shout it, scream it in their ears, Count Maldonado. Chirino Maldonado, with his huge dork of a nose, in every plot ever hatched against the Malatestas, as far back as anyone could remember. But later, after his own attempt at assassination, Sigismundo was to think, it was the music, always the music. Because if he pursued a vision of the heroic, an eidolon of human perfectibility that was to seem insane to some and eventually farcical even to himself, it had been the music that had maddened and inflamed him, the music that was produced by human beings, by men who were not in all cases admirable or noble people at all, produced many times by men who were as petulant and prancing as a French countess's spoiled poodles. But still, in the music, there was that voice, that insistent cadence of something that was not human, something toward which humans only aspire and to which they only approximate, as any circle drawn with chalk approximates to a true Platonic circle, as every soul aspires toward God, as all son of Yunos seek to attain the brilliant, blinding perfection of a Sicilian son of a Yunos. So he, Sigismundo Cellini, had an appointment with Count Maldonado, or anyway, with the first spaniel-nosed Maldonado he met. Because it was Moira, as the Greeks said, a destiny predestined, a knot woven by the fates, all of the past coming together in one vortex, just like the morning over a year ago when he woke to discover the warm white evidence of his manhood, alive and sticky on the bedsheets. And he had been afraid at first that Mama would think he had done, you know, with his hand, which was one of the most terrible sins. And now, another step towards manhood had occurred during the malign pavane in San Francesco di Paola, the mystical presence, not of Christ alone, but of death also. And he had failed. They could all treat him like a hero, but he knew he had been an oaf. He had been fencing for 3 years now, learning every riposte, feeling the knowledge sink below his mind into his muscles to function automatically. He was now at the top of the class. But that had all been a boy's playing, not adult reality. At his first real challenge, he had lost his wits, behaved as a boy against a man, easily fooled, and easily killed if the Sicilian had not had some mysterious reason to spare him. He had been clownish and lame-brained. Giancarlo Tannone would have been blisteringly sarcastic if he had performed that way in class. Tannone called that kind of thing being a brave fool and repeated continually, like his own paternoster, the brave fools die first. Tannone was a blonde northerner from Milano originally and knew more about fencing than the devil's grandmother knew about you knowing. He had taught in Firenze and Roma and even Paris before coming to Napoli to soothe his old bones in the Neapolitan sun. As sunset came finally, they sent the children to their rooms. Sigismundo stood at his window watching the sky turn tangerine and soft cinnamon, composing a variation on a Vivaldi theme in his head, making it come out the way the great, the ingenious Telemann might have done it, even though Aunt Gina was still bawling in the living room. He was perfectly serene, working on the music. He knew exactly what he was going to do. He heard Uncle Antonio's voice. I keep remembering when we were boys. He was afraid of the crocodiles in Africa that somebody told him about. Mama had to keep telling him the crocodiles never swim across the Mediterranean to Napoli. God forgive me, Uncle Pietro said. I used to tease him, saying I heard crocodiles coming up the stairs in the dark. Sigismundo remembered his own fears as a child and thought how horrible it would be to lie in bed in the darkness and listen for slithering reptiles at the door. When twilight turned to night, he lit a candle next to his bed and began writing down his new melody, adding more harmonics. He did not want to play the clavicembalo now. That would be a sacrilege. But the tune had begun to take on form so intricate that he had to capture it before it escaped. It was like Moira, fate, knitting and cackling, as she moved a million lives in a pattern none of them could see. With a crossover of the hands, the sonata would sound more like Scarlatti after the variation on the third bar, having it all planned. Where he would do it, when he would do it, how he would do it. They would have to consider him a grown-up then, with the blood red on his dagger, the blood of the Maldonado dogs. God has a reason for everything, he heard his father's voice downstairs. Sometimes I don't believe in God. That was Aunt Gina, still hysterical. Gina, not even at a time like this. The walls have ears. That was Uncle Pietro. He always called the Dominicans Dominicanis when they were out of earshot, dogs of God. a very clever knot in language. And it was true that the Dominicans were hound-like. Everybody in Napoli were afraid of those wolf-eyed bureaucrats of the Holy Inquisition. But you could say things in music that were nodded even more amusingly than saying Dominicanis. In counterpoint, you could say A and not A and both A and not A all at once, making a monkey of Aristotle and interweaving the jokes so that nobody but another musician could understand them. But everybody would be entertained without knowing why the sound was so merry and yet as inevitable as the multiplication table. If I die tomorrow, he thought, I will never write the music. I alone can hear. I will go to heaven and people will never say Cellini and Scarlatti and Vivaldi. They won't even say Scarlatti and Vivaldi and Cellini. If they say Cellini at all, it will be to refer to the family's wine business. At last he was free of the damnable books of romance. The sentence drifted up from the abyss of memory, and then he saw Uncle Pietro's face laughing, laughing helplessly until tears shone in his eyes, and he remembered the whole scene then. It was years ago, when he was only 9, and Pietro had been coaching him in French and Spanish. They were working on the great Don Quixote by the wonderful Cervantes. It was a very sad scene, but that sentence seemed unbearably hilarious to Uncle Pietro, laughing and laughing the way Sigismundo had laughed the time he and some other boys had tied a cat to the bell rope in the cathedral, and the clanging and meowing and howling had awakened the whole town. So Sigismundo asked nervously, "What is so funny there, then?" Don Quixote was broken-hearted, disillusioned, in despair. And Uncle Pietro said, "You would have to be my age to understand." Which was the kind of answer adults gave to 9-year-olds too often, especially if you tried to get any detailed information about your nose. And the reason Uncle Pietro was his favorite uncle was because he didn't talk to Sigismundo that way usually. And even on that occasion, sensing the boy's immediate resentment, Pietro added quickly, "I'm sorry. There are some jokes you cannot understand until you have been a fool many, many years and thought yourself finally cured, and then found out that you had just become a different kind of fool." And so, as he slipped between the covers and blew out the candle, Sigismundo wondered why Uncle Pietro, who was generally considered tricky enough to be able to steal Machiavelli's underwear without taking his blouse and breeches off, should consider himself a different kind of fool. And then he began to see Uncle Pietro much thinner and much taller, so that he looked like Don Quixote in the illustrations. And then Sancho Panza came in, but he didn't look like the illustrations at all. In fact, there was something dark and teratological about him. And then Sigismundo realized it was not Sancho Panza at all, but the violet-eyed assassin in the church. And then, no matter where he went, from house to house and from door to door, nobody was home. All Napoli seemed to have gone away, and as he trudged through the streets and alleys looking for help, the violet-eyed assassin was always behind him, never very close, but never very far away either. And then he was in the villa of the damnable Count Maldonado, and Maria was in the bathtub, stark naked, and he wanted to lean over and see her, you know, God forgive him. But a windmill came between them, concealing her, and then the assassin came in and started all over again, going from house to house and nobody home, Napoli empty except for him and his inexorable pursuer. So he tried to hide in the Teatro San Carlo, but the musicians were all crocodiles and they came slithering and waddling toward him, mouths agape. And it was in the darkest middle of the night as he sat up in bed, coming out of the nightmare, but still possessed by the child's mind within him, wondering if there were crocodiles hiding in the corners. "Our Father, who art in heaven," he prayed, "hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come." He finished the prayer and followed it with an Ave Maria. And then his fears were gone. He went down the back stairs to the Jakes, ordering himself not to think about the crocodiles. As he urinated, he suddenly remembered a day perhaps a year and a half ago. Uncle Leonardo had arrived in the market just after the weekly entertainment, a discussion about whose sister was or was not a you know, and he naturally asked what the excitement had been. "Just another murder," Sigismundo had answered. And Uncle Leonardo had stared at him in a melancholy way, repeating, "Just another murder. My God, boy, is that what Napoli does to us? 12-year-old, and you say, 'Just another murder.' At least say a prayer for the poor dead bastard, whoever he was." And now Uncle Leonardo was the latest victim, the latest poor dead, you know. Things were not like that in the North. They had criminals and murderers, too. Every place did. That was the result of original sin, Father Ratti said. But no other kingdom could show a record of what Uncle Pietro called unneighborly use of cutting implements, like that of the territory between Napoli and Sicily. For the first time in his life, Sigismundo wondered why it was like that. We have the greatest musicians and the best climate, and Uncle Pietro, who has been everywhere, says nobody laughs as much as Neapolitans. Why do we have so many assassins also? Going back up the stairs, he resolutely did not allow any of the lurking shadows to look like a scurrying crocodile. You could control your imagination, even if you were the temperamental artistic one in the family. Even if it was dead midnight, when, they said, graves opened and things walked that really should have crawled, and witches rode in the skies. Even if some shadows did look suspiciously like crocodiles. As he got back under the covers, he began to hear his new sonata inside his head, but just like it would sound on a real clavicembalo. He would meet his challenge tomorrow as a man fearlessly. Gradually, the clavicembalo music became more complex, more Scarlatti brilliant. He wasn't writing it anymore. And then he was in the Vatican with a gigantic chicken, and then Scarlatti himself came in, and Sigismundo had to go with the Red Indian again to find the golden waters of the Wakan, and they met crocodiles everywhere they turned in the dark forest. And then he was awake again, the sun high on the horizon above the bedroom window, half hidden by blushing clouds. He thought for a moment that all the horrors had been one long nightmare, Uncle Leonardo being killed, and trips to America to hunt crocodiles, and assassins trailing him through Napoli. But now he was awake, and it was all over. His arm hurt. He really had been stabbed. Uncle Leonardo's death was not part of the dream. He sat up and contemplated the challenge ahead. He would do it, execute the vendetta personally, and they would all have to treat him like a grown-up after that. But after he dressed and went to the garden, where the Cellines always had breakfast on sunny days, Mama's face shocked him. This is what grief looks like, he thought. There is nothing noble about it at all. It is merely ugly and pitiful, because Mama was only 33, but now she looked at least 50 or even older. He thought of the disease of the heart, which kills so many who have had sudden bereavements, and he prayed to God that it would not kill Mama. Death is like the tides and seasons, Uncle Pietro once said. There is an inevitability about it, a regularity that is almost a consolation. We may not like winter or old age, but we know they come to everybody, saints and sinners, noble Malatestas and raggedy peasants, just as the clock goes from noon to midnight for all people. But murder is not like that at all, Sigismundo thought bitterly. It's like being struck by lightning, by God's personal vindictiveness. Worse? For the survivors. Why pick on one of our family, they must ask. Does God have some special grudge against us? It is, Sigismundo thought, as if we of all the world have been selected to solve a dark riddle. We have to comprehend why, when a priest calls for God to enter the church, death can come in answer. Sigismundo said good morning to everybody without looking at anybody, embarrassed by his own pity and a guilt he could not understand. All the Cellini children were somber. Even little Guido, at the age of 4, understood enough to be subdued. Beatrice, at 8, was almost as haggard as Mama. Probably, Sigismundo thought, Beatrice is just discovering that it isn't just old men like Grandpapa who die, that she herself might die at any time. Bianca, at 6, merely looked confused. If Uncle Leonardo is in heaven, she was probably thinking, why are the grown-ups so unhappy? They silently ate figs and hard black bread dipped in olive oil and hot sausages. Papa Guido softened his bread and wine instead of olive oil, but that was not allowed to the children. Sigismundo thought of his cousin Antonio, Uncle Leonardo's son. Antonio was considered, like Sigismundo himself, sensitive, although not artistic. He was always mooning around, thinking very private thoughts. It was impossible to imagine what Antonio was feeling this morning. If it were Papa Guido instead of Uncle Leonardo, Sigismundo thought, what would my mind be like now? It was not something you could imagine, because what he was feeling now he could not have imagined before the assassination. Papa Guido finally tried to break the mood of anguish that hung over the table. Well, he said, at least the weather is still bright and sunny. Mama looked at him as if he were feeble-minded, and he looked guilty again. Sigismundo wished Uncle Pietro were there. Pietro always knew how to change the mood in a room, usually without the others even realizing he was doing it. Papa Guido said that Pietro the peddler, as he called him, could pee on your boots and convince you it was rain. But Pietro was having breakfast with his own family, Aunt Violetta and their two daughters, high up the hill on Via Capodimonte, where the Malatestas had lived for more than a century. Uncle Pietro said it was good to live up there because it gave you perspective. If you could see a whole city below you every time you looked out a window, you would become a philosopher because you would eventually realize that every time you laughed and celebrated, somebody else was alone and weeping. And every time you wept, somebody was dancing and getting drunk. And every time you passed wind, some gentle nun was singing a hymn, and it all balanced out somehow. Sigismundo looked at Mama again, then looked away quickly, guilty that he could not cure her pain. What was it, the southerner said. Christ never got south of Eboli. They meant there was no mercy down there in the hot sun, with the cruelest landlords in the world. But the way we carry on around here, Sigismundo thought, you might as well say he never got south of Roma. No wonder Nero, the king of all monsters, took his holidays here. We are his kind of people. And then breakfast was finally over and Sigismundo was free to get his dagger from the closet and head for the market. The streets that carried him downhill twisted continually, so that he was walking toward the bay one minute and away from it the next. They had been built that way to create a gentle slope for the ox carts, he knew. People must have figured that out when this was a Greek city 25 centuries ago, when it was Neapolis, new city, and the famous mermaid had just washed ashore, indicating good luck. Never trust a mermaid, Uncle Pietro said. We've had little but bad luck since then. And then, as Sigismundo descended past Via di Sapienza and Via Tribunali, as he approached his rendezvous with the Maldonados, he kept thinking of the Inferno of Dante. Down, 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 twisting and turning deeper and deeper into the heart of hell. Via di Roma at last. There was the circle of fornicators, blown about by endless winds. And Uncle Pietro said Napoli could supply the Bolgia indefinitely if the rest of the world turned celibate. And the circle of the makers of war, with their heads torn off, and the circle of the violent against art, which reminded him of the Dominicans, hounds of God, always fuming and fulminating against some painter or writer. And the circle of the usurers, buried in, you know, and the heretics who were buried upside down, and the suicides who were turned into trees. But the farther down he went, the more he thought of the circles of the treacherous and the homicidal. Still, he knew he was justified. He was doing this for Uncle Leonardo. Sigismundo often wondered how he could describe the Neapolitan market to someone who had never seen it. It wasn't just the colors, so many and so vivid. There was the improvisatore, the strolling musicians and acrobats, the endless clumping hooves of asses and oxen, the incessant whine of the beggars. One-third of the entire population of Napoli, Uncle Pietro precisely estimated. And the painted Yanos, almost as numerous as the oxen. 10 florin Yanos, young and beautiful. 5 florin Yanos, not so young anymore. Even 5 lire Yanos, popularly known as alley cats. Whores, Sigismundo thought angrily. They're called whores. If I'm going to murder a man, it's silly to worry about bad language. The colors of the banners above every shop and stall, every merchant trying to catch your eye even before you were close enough for him to catch your ear, seemed brighter and more brilliant than ever. That's because of my excitement, Sigismundo thought. Perhaps my pupils have dilated. Because the banners were like jewels, ruby red, emerald green. Stripes of blood red and angelic white, a pyramid of black on a field of indigo, all for gold, for the god of this world, as Uncle Pietro said. It was as subtle as a poke in the eye with a pointed stick. How's your middle leg, fellow? She had a soft voice with a clammy intimacy to it, like a dog's nose prodding your knee. I can straighten it out for you. Fresh fruits, all kinds of fresh fruits, get your fresh fruits here. Hottest spices this side of Constantinople. Cloth, you've never seen cloth like this. Look at these colors, signora, just look. And then Sigismundo saw the splendid brocade of Carlo Maldonado, who was not even his own age. That wasn't what he had planned. He wanted to carve up one of the Maldonado elders. And Carlo was the brother of the lovely angelic Maria. But still what? He wasn't really arguing with himself. There was a pig-nosed Maldonado, it didn't matter which one, and Sigismundo was hot in the belly and moving in fast, even though murdering a younger boy was hardly the operatic gesture he'd wished. The excitement was all through him, even hardening slightly his male organ, as if the dagger created an erotic intimacy. But he was nauseated, too, at the thought of more blood. It is enemy blood this time, he told himself harshly, not family blood. He had the dagger out and was closing in.
Peaches! Peaches! Sweetest peaches you ever tasted!
And then Uncle Pietro was between him and Carlo with a most terrible expression. There was a short chopping blow. Pietro was skilled at many arts, including combat, and the dagger hit the cobbles, clanking. To Sigismundo, it was the apocalyptic sound of a Christmas toy breaking and a boy's fantasy smashing with it.
You seem to have dropped something, Uncle Pietro said stonily. Pick it up before we attract a crowd.
Sigismundo picked up the dagger. His arm ached again as he stretched and slid it inside his cloak, his anger mounting. Of course, he thought. Uncle Pietro watched everything, read every expression, knew every secret. He probably knew what I was planning as soon as we got to the barber surgeon's yesterday. But Pietro already had an arm linked to his and was walking him rapidly downhill, away from the market, toward the bay. And it was as obvious as a mule in a drawing room. Sigismundo was still being treated like a child.
I haven't wet my pants in 11 years, Sigismundo said bitterly when they were alone. I go to the Jakes all by myself. Mama doesn't have to hold the handkerchief when I blow my nose. I am not a child, he enunciated slowly as if speaking to a lackwit.
Because when you are 14, you know that you are not a boy anymore, but it's hard to make your family realize that. You may have the proof of your manhood twice a week even without committing the sin of doing you know with your hand. So you know you could father a child already. If you were a king, they might even at this age force you to marry and order you to produce an heir. And if you failed or produced only girls, you would have to hire a food taster because they might decide to replace you with your brother.
I am not a child, Sigismundo repeated angrily. He had completed 12 sonatas, the last 3 of them really original, and had part of a sinfonia written. He could solve equations in conic sections, could recite stanza after stanza from Homer and Ovid without peeking at the crib. And over 6 months ago, he had learned from an older boy just what it is that happens to girls at that time of month they don't tell boys about. They were walking down by the docks, where the boats left twice a day for Capri.
Enough, Uncle Pietro said, his dark eyes crinkling. Regard the whole adult world as fools, if you will. That is your prerogative, the natural conclusion of any bright 14-year-old. But give me some credit as an observer. I have always watched you with special love, because of your talent. Because our ancestors, the princes of Rimini, once had interests that went beyond money-grubbing and commerce. Because I would like to think that one of us, even if he is only half Malatesta, might do something for the arts again. I watch. I notice many things. Your mother and father may still think of you as a child, but I know better.
Then it is because you have no faith in me, Sigismundo cried, because I made a fool of myself yesterday, not checking both hands before I grappled with the assassin.
No, Pietro said. Tanoni tells me you are his best pupil. You did miscalculate a bit yesterday, but they were the attackers and had surprise on their side.
Then why did you stop me? Sigismundo burst out, thoroughly exasperated.
Uncle Pietro took a silk handkerchief out of his cloak and blew his nose noisily. It was like the honk of a duck. Every sound mocks my ideals, Sigismundo thought. Nature quacks at me.
Suppose young Maldonado is smarter and faster at 12 than he ever seemed to either of us, Pietro said finally. Suppose he had killed you. How do you think your mother would take that, while she's still dazed with grief by a brother's death?
Sigismundo felt his neck and face flushing.
It wouldn't happen, he said. I am brave and trained beyond him.
But just suppose.
Sigismundo could not believe what he was hearing. It was as if Uncle Pietro had literally started quacking like a duck, or tried to persuade him that the Holy Ghost was dancing with the Archbishop on the chimneys.
You don't think, just suppose, he exclaimed. The man who thinks, just suppose, is the man who gets bowel movements on his head.
Are we to let the Maldonado dogs kill every Malatesta in Napoli because of just suppose?
How well you understand them Neapolitan code, Uncle Pietro said gently. Only 14. And you explain it as well as a man of 60. You don't think, just suppose, he repeated with a cruel mimicry of Sigismundo's tone. You don't think, he added. Sigismundo, I am going to tell you something that you will find almost incredible, as if I asserted my donkey speaks Homeric Greek. You may not even believe me, but I will tell you anyway. In the north, they cannot distinguish us from the Sicilians. They think we are all murderous, black-hearted bastards south of Roma. And it is because of this damned code of vendetta. Everybody knows northerners are effeminate. Like Giancarlo Tononi. Well, he's different. How did I get trapped into defending the masculinity of my fencing teacher?
Sigismundo, Uncle Pietro asked. Who told you Count Maldonado hired those assassins yesterday?
Nobody had to tell me. The feud...
Ah, the feud, yes. Pietro put his hand on Sigismundo's shoulder. I do not expect to have Count Maldonado for dinner this year, or even next year, or even in 1780 if I live that long. But I have been working quietly and patiently to end that imbecile feud, and, after many years, I have evidence that the Count wishes it to end also. The feud is dwindling away after more than 100 years. We all got excruciatingly tired of it, and it is bad for business.
Sigismundo felt something very familiar, something that came over him every time he played chess with Uncle Pietro. The Maldonados had nothing to do with the murder? He asked wretchedly.
Nothing, Uncle Pietro said. You were about to brutally kill a child younger than yourself for no damned reason at all. Because you are like all of Napoli after 1,000 years of conquest, you believe it is honorable to be angry and violent and quick, and you don't want to find out what the flaming hell is actually going on.
So, Sigismundo said. He was no longer furious because he was learning something, as he had learned something when he had finally figured out the Noah's Ark trap with which Uncle Pietro had won so many chess games.
Tell me, he said, I will listen.
You are as philosophical as most men twice your age, Uncle Pietro said. That is to say, you are willing to listen to reason after I have forcibly restrained you from running amok.
Please, Uncle, I know I was a fool.
The bright, magnificent star of Sacred Heart College, Father Ratti, Uncle Pietro said. He has spoken of our late philosopher, Dr. Giambattista Vico?
Yes. He also warned us that some say Dr. Vico was a heretic. That is often the name given to a man who is lucky enough to have an original idea. Do you recall what Vico said about the economic classes in society?
At certain times, Sigismundo said, the classes turn upon each other, and there is a war between them. It happens when the conditions are ripe, just as a Homer happens when people are ready for an Odyssey, or a Nero happens when monsters are inevitable. There is an intelligence in the species that produces appropriate men and women for each situation, just as the intelligence in my body produces hair and fingernails as I need them. That is what I remember.
It is more complicated, Uncle Pietro said. There are various depths in what Aristotle called psychology. Those who dig very deep, who almost touch the bottom of the psyche, are poets or creators in the general sense. They bring up new metaphors that are new ways of seeing ourselves and our world. When these visions are spread among a people, they become myths and then harden into laws. This is a process that is always continuing. New metaphors and myths are being found by creative people all the time. It can be most violent and explosive.
Do the musicians have any role in this?
All creators have a role, since all are poets in Vico's sense of the term. Newton is as much of a poet as Homer, since he gives us a whole world, and your beloved Scarlatti is a poet in this sense also. That is why Plato banned original music in his Republic. He feared the violent changes a new myth can unleash. He knew, before Vico, that a myth can trigger a war between the classes. That is why every secret society has its own myth. You must have heard sermons denouncing such cults. The reason there are so many sermons about this is because there are so many of these clandestine societies in our kingdom.
Pietro lowered his voice. Such groups always flourish in conquered nations, when the government is a bunch of thieving foreigners. He lowered his voice further. You have heard of M-A-A-F-A-E-A?
Of course, Sigismundo said. Morta alla Francia Italia anella. Death to all the French, Italy cries.
They're a bunch of sleazy Siciliana who think they can drive the Bourbons out of Napoli and Sicily.
There is now a new group who have separated themselves out of the Mafia, Uncle Pietro said. They call themselves Rossi, after the red flag that was the emblem of the plebeian regiments in the Roman army. They want to kill all of us who are rich, not just the Bourbons.
The secret police know about this? Sigismondo asked, shocked.
Of course, Uncle Pietro said, but the Rossi are very clever. They appear and disappear like the devils in an opera, as if our whole world, and not just the opera house, was full of trapdoors. However, have you heard of the Carbonari?
Sigismondo nodded. Everybody knew of the mysterious coal burners who were famous for their anonymous charitable activities.
This is where it gets Byzantine, Uncle Pietro said. Now you will learn that political history is a kind of philosophical spaghetti.
The coal burners, Uncle Pietro went on, were originally a band of mystics living in Scotland, at least according to legend.
One day, the King of France is said to have stumbled upon one of their retreats while he was lost. Some versions of the story say this was Francis I, and he had been out hunting one day, rode ahead of his party, and became hopelessly confused when darkness fell, wandering aimlessly until he found himself in Scotland.
That is absurd, Sigismundo said. I've heard that story and cannot believe it. Are we to think the good Francis I was so absent-minded that he swam the English Channel on horseback without noticing all that water?
It was like being told the king was so dumb he couldn't find his, you know, with both hands.
The legend is a very simple allegory, Uncle Pietro said. Scotland is a code word for a state of mind, not a physical place on the surface of the earth. The Carbonari have many names in many nations, but like all other Masonic brotherhoods, they always say they have a secret inner group in Scotland. This inner leadership is in a state of special mental focus called illumination.
France, in this code, means darkness. When the King of France, or of darkness, met the coal burners of Scotland, he had been lost and hungry for days. This myth means that he was confused and aware of his spiritual ignorance, like Dante in Selva Scura. The coal burners fed him and cared for him. This means they gave him spiritual light, as Virgil did for Dante. The burning coal symbolizes this illumination. The King of Darkness was then able to see beyond the phenomenal and contingent world to the eternal and non-contingent.
But what does all this have to do with the Rossi? Sigismundo was confused.
Patience. You have heard of the Alumbrados?
Of course. Father Ratti had taught and refuted the doctrines of every heresy, from Arianism onward. A Jesuit education did not scant.
You will remember that the Alumbrados, the name was Spanish for Illuminati, were condemned by the Inquisition in 1623. That was a long time ago, you might say. Nonetheless, they still exist.
I know, Sigismundo said. Father Ratti told us that every heresy changes its name when it's condemned and comes back in a new form.
The Alumbrados, Uncle Pietro went on somberly, believed, like the Gnostics, that Satan was literally the god of this world. He created matter to hide the spiritual light from us with a filter, as it were. And he is the secret chief, these maniacs say, of all bishops and kings and nobles, all the rich and powerful and mighty. They believed original Christianity can be restored only when all men and women are equal, and there is no hierarchy or structure anywhere.
Yes, Father Ratti said they should be called anarchicos, those who deny all authority.
They believed, and still believe, that when there are no pope and no king, no property and no marriage, no restrictions on anybody, we shall all have the same miraculous powers as Jesus and the first apostles, to heal the sick and blind, to walk on water, to raise the dead. Maybe they expect to multiply loaves and fishes, too.
So we still have Alumbrados among us today, Sigismundo interrupted, trying to get to the point?
Yes. But they call themselves Carbonari.
What?
The way to survive when your movement has been condemned and outlawed is to be very subtle. Pretending to be somebody else is a first step.
This is all like Don Quixote rewritten by Machiavelli, Sigismundo protested.
Let me try to see if I follow.
There are Rossi, who were part of Mafia, but aren't anymore. There are Carbonari, who do charitable works and teach spiritual enlightenment. There are also Alumbrados, who pretend to be Carbonari,
but are actually more like Rossi.
You understand it so far, Pietro said calmly. The Alumbrados and the Rossi, I believe, are actually allied at this point, but you have the general picture.
Ma che, Sigismundo muttered, if I were to go to join the Carbonari to help them in their praiseworthy works of charity, I might be much worse for my efforts, right? Because I wouldn't know if I had found the true Carbonari, or just the maniacal Alumbrados posing as Carbonari.
Exactly, Uncle Pietro said. God makes many fools, but the world is so constructed that only the wise and lucky die of old age.
I see what you mean about philosophical spaghetti, Sigismundo said. It is spaghetti alla marinara, in fact. The cook threw in everything but his horse.
He pondered a while.
And just how is it, he asked finally, that you are so sure it was these Rossi or Alumbrados who murdered Uncle Leonardo?
I have my own sources of information, Uncle Pietro said, in a tone that tried to close that subject. But he added vaguely, a large business like ours, we control most of the wine in southern Italy, I hope you realize. Well, we cannot afford to be ignorant.
Do you mean you have your own secret police, just like the court? Sigismundo exclaimed.
We have our sources, Pietro replied. Let it go at that.
Oh, of course, there is the matter of the black uniforms the assassins wore. That is an old trademark of the Alumbrados. It proves that they and the Rossi are now virtually one.
Sigismundo remembered that Uncle Pietro often met with strange men from far places who seemed to have little or nothing to do with the wine business, and that they often shook hands with him in a peculiar way when leaving. They usually muttered something about squares and levels during these strange handshakes.
Masonry. Of course, many honest men were masons, but it smacked of heresy. It was a Machiavellian business. Secret societies competing with secret societies, secret police spying on secret societies, a warfare in the darkness with few clues to distinguish friend from foe.
The Rossi, Uncle Pietro resumed, have been using assassination as a terror tactic for a long time. You know, it is a hard life on the latifondi down here. The sun is too hot, the crops fail more often than in decent climates. The peasants work like donkeys, and still the sun burns up the crops too often. The landlords are merciless because their own success is only marginal at best. What can you expect in such a situation? Banditry and murder are more common than horse turds if you get off the main roads. It has always been a powder keg waiting for someone to strike the match. The Rosso ideology is that match. Sigismundo was confused again. But the Bible says we will always have the poor with us. Do the Reds think they can change the laws of God?
The Bible also says, thou shalt not kill, Pietro replied, lowering his voice still more, a habit rather than a rational precaution, since they were far from anyone who could overhear.
Princes and prime ministers never seem to notice that passage.
Siggy, let me tell you, everybody finds in the Bible what he wants and conveniently ignores the rest. Do the holy monks of the Inquisition remember thou shalt not kill when they set a man on the pyre?
Are you comparing the Rossi to the Inquisition? Sigismundo cried. That is worse than your Dominicani's joke. All those visits to England must have made you half Protestant.
I was carried away by my rhetoric, Pietro said quickly.
The Dominicans act directly under the infallible command of our Holy Father the Pope, who is the divine representative of God on earth. I meant no sarcasm. We are the luckiest people in Europe. Where others flounder about in endless confusion and perpetual questioning, we have these good, holy men to tell us when we are thinking correctly, and to correct us with proper firmness when we stray into error.
Still, once you admit that God wants us to kill the bad people, it is a matter of some careful judgment, is it not, to decide whom the bad people are?
The Rossi do not know it is heretics and Jews. They think it is anyone with a clean shirt on.
Sigismundo became angry again.
You are mocking me. You are not saying what you really think. I am not a boy. I keep telling you, and I recognize irony when I hear it.
Pietro sighed.
What I believe, he said, is a matter between me and my Creator, and we will discuss it at length when we meet face to face, and if he disagrees with me, I will immediately defer to his judgment, since he has much more experience and vaster knowledge.
There was a silence. The bay was as tranquil as an old man saying his rosary.
Then a pelican dove into the water and came up with a fish in its mouth, chewing it. Just another murder, but part of nature, part of God's plan. The poor are all ignorant and lazy, Sigismundo said finally. These Rossi, or Alumbrados, or whatever they call themselves these days, must be great fools to think society can survive without the well-born and educated to guide it. They are also great fools to think they can change this kingdom by adding more murders to its bloody history, Pietro said softly. That is a matter of philosophy, however. Right now, we are discussing what a hot-blooded 14-year-old male should do with his energies. I assure you, my contacts are at work already trying to find which of the mad dogs of the Rossi killed my brother. It is a deadly, dangerous business, and until you are a little older, you might trust it to my hands, I think. Yes, Sigismundo said, of course. Concentrate on your music, Uncle Pietro said sternly. Develop your own style and stop imitating the Scarlatti nobody ever heard of but you. Leave murder to the professionals. I'm sorry, Sigismundo said lamely. You should be. Everybody is preparing for Leonardo's funeral, the second our family has had this year, and you rush about trying to create more murder and raise havoc. The undertakers are getting rich off us already. Must they earn enough from our family to start lending at interest and organize their own bank? I was a fool, Sigismundo said. Of course, you say that now, Uncle Pietro said. But do you understand, really? It frightens me. I didn't understand anything at your age, but I was sly enough to say what the adults expected of me. I hope you're not playing that game. A boy your age is almost an adult, but only to the extent that an iron tub falling downstairs is almost melody. Listen to me, Siggy. You may live a long time and write glorious music, and everybody will say, the noble Cellini, our greatest composer since Vivaldi. Or you can try to be a hero with no real knowledge of the evil of this wicked world, and people will say, that Cellini boy, he was a tough customer. He chewed up walls and chimneys and spat out the bricks. Even the Sicilians crossed the street when they saw him coming. Too bad he died so young. I know. I know. God damn it, I hope you know, Pietro gazed upon the repentant face of the boy. Sometimes, he added, I think you play upon me, and upon the whole family, as you do upon the clavicembalo. I never know what you are really thinking. You knew this morning, Sigismundo said wretchedly. Yes, well, maybe you have learned a lesson, but you are a sly one. I will be watching you. Any man will listen to reason for a while, but when the passions rise, reason is as quickly forgotten as the graffiti in a shithouse. Pietro Malatesta was right. 2 hours later, Sigismundo decided how to pursue his vendetta against the illuminated Rossi, or Alumbrados, or whatever they called themselves. When Sigismundo went to the royal palace and explained his offer, the head of the guards laughed at him. But I am a Malatesta, Sigismundo told him hotly. We are the oldest nobility in the kingdom. You cannot treat me like this. You are a beardless Malatesta and no more than 16, the guardsman said. Go home before I spank you. Sigismundo trudged away thinking, persistence. I will wear them down, and the Malatesta legend will finally penetrate. Besides, it was cheerful news that he looked 2 years older than his actual age. It's the way I wear my sword, and what Tanone taught me about carriage, he thought. It's obvious that I am a dangerous character. But then, in the night, in his dreams, the Rossi came back to him, wearing their plain black wool as a symbol of humility, or a satanic caricature of a religious order, slashing, stabbing, murdering every Malatesta and Cellini, turning crocodiles on Sigismundo in the worst of the nightmares. And his father, Papa Guido, was grim all that spring, as Napoli bloomed more beautifully than ever, the fig trees and olive trees and the emerald green apple trees spreading their scents in the air and the white Neapolitan sunlight everywhere. God's gift to Napoli, Uncle Pietro once said in a very low voice, to compensate us for the buggering Bourbons that inscrutable history had wished on us. But perpetual shadows, it seemed, hanging all over the Cellinas and Malatestas, Aunt Gina in particular a haggard figure in her black dress of mourning, no longer the prettiest woman in the city, but a stark, brooding presence out of tragic opera.
Sigismundo almost feared she would burst into a soprano aria at any moment and then stab herself during the final arpeggio.
So what else could he do but tell his soul, "Be patient. Wait. The time will come. I have an appointment somewhere in some green field with seconds and sabers, or in some filthy alley with daggers. But now I must wait and learn what it is to be a man." And meanwhile, there was the music, the language of the angels themselves, which everybody was urging on him. Uncle Pietro, especially, who kept saying, "Nobody remembers dead wine merchants. Everybody remembers Costanzo Festa, and he's been buried 200 years now." Which was the one thing wrong with Uncle Pietro. He was always going on about Festa and people like that. Pretty tune makers, but not at all comparable to a man like Scarlatti in Spain, who had found whole dimensions in music, and that Uncle Pietro and Napoli as a whole refused to recognize. And in fact, Uncle Pietro did not even approve of Scarlatti's crossover technique when Sigismundo showed it to him, how one hand crosses over the other on the clavicembalo so that more complex harmony is possible. A whole new music would grow out of that, Sigismundo knew. A music even greater than that of Father Vivaldi, the Red Priest, who was currently everybody's favorite. Because bel canto, at which Vivaldi, the priest with the rooster red hair, excelled over all the world, was the heart and soul of music. Everybody knew that. But harmony was its searching mind, and the mind of music was becoming mature in the century, struggling towards forms of counterpoint and intricacy that were tragic and comic at once, and therefore beyond comedy or tragedy, beyond concept and beyond intellect, beyond what analysis knew or poetry imagined. After a month and a half, Sigismundo had been to the court 5 times, always careful, always checking that the all-observant eye of Uncle Pietro was elsewhere occupied. Of course, they continued to laugh at him. Ferdinand IV, even at the age of 13, 1 year younger than Sigismundo, had the typical Bourbon attitude about ordinary Neapolitans trying to involve themselves in government. The 6th time Sigismundo returned, the head of the guard was dryly ironic instead of openly sarcastic, and took Sigismundo inside. The name Malatesta had registered finally, the boy thought. Evidently, the Marchese Bernardo di Tanucci, who really ran the government, had told these clods who the mighty Malatestas were. They went to a room where 2 men were waiting. The guardsmen left at once. Sigismundo was alone, he knew, with di Tanucci's boys, agents of the secret police. One of the men was a Neapolitan with a barbaric Sicilian-looking face. He seemed to be breathing and awake, but beyond that, he was not doing any more than a chamber pot and was about equally attractive. This one is from interrogation, Sigismundo thought uneasily. The 2nd man conducted the interview. He had a walrus mustache and white blonde hair, and as soon as he spoke, Sigismundo knew he was an Englishman, but not the I-know-bloody-everything type of conceited-ass Englishman. His Italian was finicky, like that of the Roman rich. "You are the musician who believes he has a talent for espionage," the Englishman said. There were a lot of these mysterious Englishmen in Napoli. They belonged to a strange group called the Jacobites, of which Sigismundo knew little and cared less. But everybody knew they could not return to England under penalty of death. "Casanova is a musician," Sigismundo replied boldly in English, "and he has proved useful to more than one prince." "And a royal pain in the bum to some," the Englishman said, registering Sigismundo's talent for language. "God's pajamas, lad. There are some of us who think a freelance agent is worse than no agent at all. I would never hire a man who is for sale to the highest bidder." "I am not for sale," Sigismundo said firmly. "I offer my complete loyalty to Ferdinand IV. He is my prince." "He's a Bourbon. Auntie's drawers, I am not so feeble-minded as to think you Neapolitans really adore being governed by foreigners." The Neapolitan gorilla just stared. It was not an unfriendly stare, but emphatically nowhere near being a friendly one. It missed nothing. "If you don't trust me, why are you talking to me at all?" Sigismundo asked sharply. "Why, for that matter, do you serve the Bourbons?" The Englishman relaxed. "You have a debater's skills," he said. "I almost think I should be on the defensive now. Why don't you sit down and see if we can be of use to each other?" Sigismundo took a chair, observing the Englishman more carefully. As Giancarlo Tanone had taught him,
to study an opposing fencer. This man was past 50 and had probably been involved in clandestine activities most of his life. You could never really trick him because he would never trust you fully. The Jacobites had been exiled from England for trying to overthrow one king and install another. They were living all over Europe now, but Napoli had a particularly high concentration of them. If this man was working for the Spanish Bourbons, it was probably with only part of his devious English mind. A perfectly sane Englishman, Uncle Pietro said, could logically decide on monstrosities that would curl the hair of a Sicilian bandit. I am serving Ferdinand, the Englishman said, switching to Spanish, because I'm a Catholic. Increasing Catholic power is, to me, the only way Europe will ever come out of the age of wars and chaos that Protestantism has produced. Does that answer your question? Yes, Sigismundo thought. When there are enough strong Catholic monarchs again, they can combine and drive the Protestants off the throne of England. But why is he telling me this? You wonder why I am telling you this, the Englishman went on, shocking Sigismundo. So, even the English may have the witch power sometimes. I want you to understand that there are wheels within wheels. I am watched day and night. Signor di Tenucci appreciates my special talents, but he wonders always when my interests and Bourbon interests might begin to diverge. If you use me, Sigismundo said, switching to French, I'll impress him yet. You are telling me I will be watched also. God's hooks, the Englishman said in his own language again. You have the kind of mind that can appreciate these games, but tell me, what is the most absurd feature of this whole interview? My age, Sigismundo said quietly, waiting. The Englishman grinned. That is precisely why this might work, he said. Not even the Alumbrados would suspect us of using a lad of your years. That is why I'm talking to you. Do you think you are brave? The question came suddenly. Yes, I have been fencing for 4 years. And you tackled an assassin barehanded when your uncle was killed. Don't be startled. We know a great deal about you. As soon as you first came to the palace, we started an investigation. But a spy must be intelligent as well as brave. Do you think you are intelligent? The gorilla was still staring. He seemed to have about as many nervous fidgets as a tombstone. I am intelligent enough to know that this is leading up to some sort of a test, Sigismundo said.
That is extraordinary, the Englishman exclaimed.
He opened a drawer in his desk, almost absent-mindedly. But to be a spy, he went on softly, too softly, is to deal continually with intrigue, uncertainty, treachery, to find surprises when you least expect them. He had taken a pistol out of the drawer. Sigismundo hated guns. The sword was a weapon of elegance, of art, of honor. Guns simply killed people, even at a distance, without giving them a chance to fight back. They were ugly, and he refused to learn anything about them. The Englishman casually pointed the pistol at Sigismundo and smiled. It was not a nice smile by any means. The Sabine women must have seen that kind of smile on the faces of the Roman soldiers. This is where he rams it into me all the way, Sigismundo thought. It is not the policy of the palace to encourage Neapolitans to meddle in affairs of the sort we are discussing, the Englishman said. It is the policy to discourage them. There was a pulse beating in Sigismundo's temple. He ignored it and breathed as Tononi had taught him. This is a test, as I said, he stated calmly. You are quite sure of that? Yes. The pulse was beating faster. Sigismundo ruthlessly ignored it and watched the Englishman's eyes and mouth. Those were the places where signals would show, telling you what to expect. The Englishman put the gun back in the drawer. One learns the most amazing things about people in moments like this, he said. Of course, it was a minor little test, and of course you knew it, but you showed something to me. I like you, lad. The Neapolitan gorilla grunted, as if he was disappointed that he hadn't had to hit Sigismundo with a lead pipe to keep him from wrestling for the gun. Maybe he doesn't talk or walk at all, Sigismundo thought. They might just keep him around to look like the second murderer in a revenge tragedy. And so, Sigismundo Cellini found himself working for an Englishman who claimed to be called Mr. Drake,
which probably meant his real name was Jones or Greenhill, allegedly to aid the secret police of Ferdinand IV in rooting out the Rosso assassins. And, of course, Sigismundo wondered to what extent he might also be helping the Jacobites to change English politics, about which he cared not at all. And Drake, after Sigismundo left, wrote a brief note saying only, "The mouse has taken the cheese," and sent the Neapolitan agent to deliver it to the appropriate person. But Sigismundo did not know that. But Sigismundo was not yet a perfect fool. As Uncle Pietro said, perfection always takes a while. Sigismundo sought out Father Ratti, the most enlightened of his teachers at Sacred Heart College. "All those Englishmen who live around Capodimonte," he asked, "why are they called Jacobites?" They were walking in the college garden. Father Ratti was old enough to pass as Caesar's grandfather, so wrinkled was his face, but his eyes were lively and brightly curious. Like all Jesuits, he could argue the case against any church dogma as well as the case for it. That was because of their training in dialectics. "The Jacobites," he said quickly, ticking off the facts with no effort, "were followers of the late King Jacobus, or, as they say in their language, James II. You must remember the Bloodless Revolution, as it was called. The English nobles in the Parliament wanted a Protestant monarch, so they deposed James and imported his son-in-law, William of Orange, from Holland. The Jacobites tried to restore James, and now that James is dead, the Jacobites are allegedly trying to place his grandson Charles on the throne." "The Jacobites are Catholics, then?" Sigismundo asked, somewhat relieved. "Most of them. But they have many Protestants among them, because the royal family of the Stuarts, to which James and Charles belong, is Scottish. Many of the Scots support the Jacobites, even though Charles is Catholic, because they would like a Scottish family back on the throne of England." "You mean the Jacobites are an alliance of English Catholics and Scottish Protestants?" Sigismundo was astonished. "They are said to be Freemasons, too," Father Ratti added calmly. "Some say, in fact, that all Masonic lodges are just fronts for the Jacobite conspiracy. The Carbonari, the secret inner chiefs in Scotland. Charles, the priest, was going on, or, as they call him in their language, Bonnie Prince Charlie, has about as much chance of gaining the English crown as I have of flapping my arms and flying off like a stork. The last Jacobite coup, or attempted coup, ended in total failure. They were terribly beaten at a place called Culloden Moor in Scotland in 1746. Bonnie Prince Charlie, I'm told, is resolutely devoting his remaining energies to drinking himself to death in Roma." "I see," Sigismundo thought. "They want to put a Catholic drunk on the throne of a Protestant country. They are indeed idealists." "Is it true that the Alumbrados still survive?" he asked. He knew the answer. He just wanted the digressions that would come when Ratti started ransacking his memory. "Well," Father Ratti said, "if one believes our good and pious friends, the Dominicans, every heresy since Adamatism still survives somewhere, and if the Pope looked under his bed every night, he'd eventually find a Manichaean hiding there. Do you think your uncle was murdered by these Alumbrados?" The abrupt question was a shock. "Well," Sigismundo said, "I heard some men in my family talking. It was suggested." "It might be true," old Ratti said somberly. "Do you know what the clue is? The timing of the murder, having it coincide with the blessing of the host. That is deliberate, calculated blasphemy of exactly the flavor of the Alumbrado madness. Do you recall from history class the murder of Guillaume de Medici in 1478? "Yes," Sigismundo said, suddenly seeing an impossible possibility. "Guillaume was killed at the moment of the raising of the host," the Jesuit said sorrowfully, "just like your uncle. The Alumbrados may not be as recent as we think. It was an organized conspiracy that killed Julius Caesar. It was an Egyptian oracle, intoxicated on wine and strange drugs, who told Alexander the Great to invade India, and who knows what powers were behind the oracle. Any violent, emotional person can easily be converted into an oracle, a trance medium, a virtual automaton, by those who know the techniques of mind control. St. Paul says the church must war, not against flesh and blood, but against powers from elsewhere." "But what is the purpose of such blasphemy as committing murder when God is called down into the church?"
Sigismundo asked, beginning to feel a new sensation that was worse than physical fear.
Strange drugs. Mind control. Powers from elsewhere. Conspiracies as old and evil and bloody as Moloch, the child-eating god of Carthage.
Perhaps I will begin to sound like a Dominican, Father Ratti said as they turned into the main hall leading to the library. According to the confessions obtained by the Inquisitors, no man may be admitted to the inner circle of these illuminated ones until he has committed three major sins, sodomy and murder and blasphemy. In that way, they break all ties with the Christian community. All that the Alumbrados say about restoring original Christianity is just for the outer circles, the dupes. The inner rulers of the cult hate Christ as well as the church. They despise morality as well as civil law. They aim not just at anarchism, but at universal atheism.
Sigismundo made the sign of the cross, almost trembling.
Yes, old Roddy went on, you do well to fear such men.
He turned to enter the library, then abruptly turned back.
Tell your Uncle Pietro that I answered all your questions, he said. Tell him I did it for the widow's son.
It was obviously a code phrase of some sort. Sigismundo felt the wheels were turning faster than he could understand. Wheels within wheels, as Drake said.
Maybe the Freemasons were a front for some continent-wide Jacobite plot, with Drake as a kingpin.
Certainly Uncle Pietro knew the Masonic hand grips, and how much else? How old were the Carbonari? And was the secret group in Scotland only an allegory? And the opposition, the illuminated ones, or Rossos, who hated Christ and government, rich men and priests with equal fervor, who killed in church to crown murder with blasphemy?
Wheels within wheels, faster and faster, and he would be going down, down, down into this web of treachery, down to the blackest bulgia of all, where were found the avatars of Satan himself, the violent against God and man.
It was only a day later that Mr. Drake contacted Sigismundo, through a man who looked like but did not exactly talk like a peasant. The message was brief. They would meet at a villa high on Capodimonte that afternoon. When Sigismundo arrived, he was overwhelmed. Not even the Malatestas had such a pleasant home. The Jacobites must have gotten away with a lot of their money when they fled England. Uncle Pietro said that traitor was a word so unspeakably vile that in common courtesy it was applied only to losers. Sigismundo wondered how rich the winners in England might be. There was a magnificent Venus in the garden. Sigismundo couldn't tell if it was a Roman original or one of the countless forgeries that proliferated these days.
You like her? Drake asked, noticing Sigismundo's glance.
The priests say such art is dangerous, it can lead to sin.
Sin is a term in theology, Drake said.
Beauty is a term in aesthetics.
Mixing the two is like multiplying apples by altar boys.
I thought you said you were a Catholic.
I am, Drake said, as my enemies in England will add, an unmitigated reactionary to boot. What I admire in Mother Church is her blatant pagan beauty. Catholicism has all the qualities of the greatest artworks. Sublimity, mystery, grandeur, and a transcendental inner coherence to be found nowhere in the real world. By the way, the Vatican has an even better Venus. I've seen it. In fact, a certain famous cardinal once autographed it, when he had a bit too much wine aboard. Perhaps I had better not mention where the cardinal put his autograph on her.
Drake laughed coarsely, glancing with more aesthetic appreciation at the naked goddess, patron of love and pleasure.
Sigismundo was uncomfortable. One did not discuss popes and cardinals that way, not in Napoli anyway.
Drake quickly got to business. A bundle of rags was produced. It took Sigismundo a moment to realize this filth was the clothing of a peasant.
Get out of your silks and into these.
Sigismundo removed his clothes and donned the reeking uniform of poverty.
Good enough, Drake said, looking him over. But you don't smell rank enough. 20 push-ups, please.
Sigismundo exercised.
Drake studied him afterwards and rubbed some soil on his neck.
Tell me about how God made the world, he said then, the way one of your servants would explain it.
Sigismundo got 3 sentences out before Drake stopped him.
You just bleeding said entelechy, he howled. Do your servants read Aristotle?
Of course not, they can't read at all.
Then, by the sacred chamber pot of the Holy Virgin, do you think the bleeding peasants read Aristotle?
They went over the creation 3 times before Sigismundo caught the knack of using only lower-class words.
Ask me for the afternoon off to visit your sick mother, Drake said then.
Sigismundo thought an instant. He carefully removed his straw peasant's hat as a sign of respect and began,
Pardon, signor. Jesus Christ and his black brother Harry, Drake screamed. You are looking right at me.
Sigismundo lowered his eyes, as peasants must when addressing their superiors, and started again. After an hour of this sort of practice, Drake was somewhat near satisfied.
Do you know where the Osteria Allegro is?
He asked. Sigismundo nodded dubiously. That was a bad neighborhood, one he had never entered.
We have reason to believe the Rossi do some of their recruiting there, Drake said. You are Antonio Mostra from Marchiaro. Your landlord has raised the rent so high that your father cannot pay, understand?
There is nothing left over after the rent is paid.
Nothing. Two of your sisters have come to town to work as harlots, but still there is not enough. Your father is terribly ashamed, but he does not forbid them. A man's conscience, ethics, and morals are luxuries, but food is a bleeding necessity.
I was homeless for 3 years. I know about such things.
But, as I was saying, your family is near starvation. You are going to drink and complain, understand?
But be careful, don't drink so much that you really get drunk.
Sigismundo wondered if he was crazy to get himself into such a masquerade, but he remembered Uncle Leonardo's blood.
I may be sending you to your death, Drake said at the gate, but God is on the side of the damned fools and optimists, sometimes. Good luck, my brave musician.
And so it was again, down, down, down through the curving Neapolitan hills, deeper and deeper, until he was going further down than ever before, past the market, into the pits of squalor. He thought of Dante again. The nobles high up on Capodimonte and other peaks were like the thrones of the Paradiso. The merchants below them on the lower hills and in the center of town were like the souls in the Purgatorio, struggling to achieve the golden grace to join the blessed souls above. And down, at the very bottom, were the monstrosities of that hell on earth, poverty. The stink became intolerable. It was a mixture of sewage that never drained properly, and stale sweat, and raw fish, and vomit, and one winehouse after another. Even animals were never this filthy. This was why the great Aristotle said that common people would never be capable of self-government. The sights were even worse than the odors. Small children, half or completely naked, playing in the dirt. Men, too drunk to walk, leaning against walls as they tried to urinate without splashing their boots. The blind, the legless, the armless. Veterans of God knows what armies, paid once and then cast out, no longer useful for dismembering other men. People with unspeakable swellings and tumors. Harlots too old or too ugly for the market, working here to cadge a few coins from men as poor as themselves. The half a lira uprights, or rowboats, that drunken sailors would do, you know, to standing up, leaning against an alley wall. And then on a fence he saw, La terra trema.
Somebody down here can read and write, he thought. But then the meaning sank home. The earth will shake. It was not necessarily scrawled by some religious fanatic, predicting apocalypse. It might be a Rosso warning, to him and all his class. La terra trema! La terra trema! It was like a drumbeat entering the score of an opera, promising you that the stage would be thoroughly littered with corpses of tenors, baritones, basses, and sopranos at the final curtain. So when he found the Osteria Allegro and began drinking, it did not require histrionic talent to express bitterness and melancholy. All he had to do was remember he was a peasant's son who hated his landlord. His wild emotions were real. He did not understand why the world was so vile, nor why an innocent bystander like Uncle Leonardo had been brutally murdered because the world was vile. Maybe he was too shaken by this new Napoli, this Napoli he had never known. Maybe he forgot Drake's warning about not drinking too much. The more wine he drank, the more he raged against all he had learned since Easter Sunday. A priest calls on God, and 4 murderers appear in answer. Uncle Leonardo is butchered like a hog in an abattoir because some madman blame him for the accumulated injustices of thousands of years.
Most people live in misery, while a few wear silks and eat caviar imported from Constantinople. God has a reason for it all, Sigismundo reminded himself. God always has a reason. God is all-wise and all-good. To prove it, he will reward these wretched people with an eternity of bliss in heaven after they starve to death, and to show his transcendent perfection even further, he will personally burn in hell every desperate girl who left a ruined latifondi to come to the city and intercourse men in alleys. And now God was making the bloody room spin around. Maybe you couldn't trust God after all. But then he noticed the bartender had not warned him that his rambling diatribe was dangerous. He was in the right place, no doubt about it. And so, when another peasant invited him to come along to a party where the drinks were free, he was only moderately surprised that it had been so easy. And when they were on the street and the peasant said that the party was actually, well, a kind of political meeting, Sigismundo carefully hid his exultation. But when they arrived at the baraka or hut where the party or, well, kind of political meeting was being held, everybody already there was wearing hoods that hid their faces. Dante's caena tende, Sigismundo thought. The bottom pit. Bulgia of the violent traders. On the walls were black candles, just like at a witch's sabbat. There was even a kind of altar with a huge black book and a red flag covering the wall behind it. Who comes here? One hooded figure, who seemed to be in charge, asked suspiciously. One who seeks the light, replied Sigismundo's guide. That was probably ritualistic. El Aswad, said another voice. I say that the stranger should be removed. We do not know him. El Aswad was Arabic, Sigismundo knew. It meant black man and was a title of Satan. El Aswad, said Sigismundo's guide, if we do not teach the stranger who comes to us, how will we spread the light? More ritual, obviously. We will examine the stranger later, said El Aswad. He ceremoniously removed a dagger from his belt and raised it to the north, east, south, and west. I call up Orpheus, he intoned. I call up Tana. I call up Lucifer. I call up Aradia. The dagger was placed upon the book, pointing south. Orpheus, Tana, Lucifer, Aradia, everybody repeated. What is the first duty of a master mason? Demanded El Aswad. To see that the baraka is secure, came the chorus. See to it, intoned El Aswad. Guards moved to the two doors. They removed daggers from their belts and held them, point upward, at their breasts. Now I am locked in with them, Sigismundo thought. What is the second duty of a master mason? Asked El Aswad. To fight to the death against the accursed Pope and all the damnable nobles, came the answer. What is the third duty of a master mason? To journey to the east to find the light. The sun rises in the east, of course, but there seemed to be a double meaning there. Sicily had been under Moslem rule for a long time. El Aswad was an Arabic title. Could baraka be a pun on Arabic baraka, soul power? The first duty is to see that the baraka, the power, is in the circle. Who is the new candidate for illumination? El Aswad asked suddenly. Sigismundo tried not to tense. He is a poor peasant's son. Their family is wretched because of a cruel landlord, Sigismundo's guide said. How do we know he is not a police spy? El Aswad demanded. Sigismundo felt a belch coming on and deliberately let it out explosively. Who, me? He asked, exaggerating his drunkenness. I don't know any police. Come here, El Aswad said sternly. Sigismundo lurched forward, still playing the drunk. Let me see your hands, El Aswad ordered. Sigismundo felt his heart begin to pound rapidly. With effort, he kept his face impassive. You may be born male, he reminded himself, but you have to earn the right to be a man. He held out his hands, and by sheer will, he kept them from trembling. Those are not the hands of a peasant, El Aswad said. Those are the hands of a goat-copulating aristocrat who has never worked a day in his worthless life. Sigismundo was suddenly surrounded by hooded figures. His belly lurched in terror, and he told himself, the coward is controlled by fear. The brave man ignores it. But his heart pounded louder. Who are you? One of the hooded figures asked, holding a dagger to Sigismundo's throat.
I am Antonio Mostra from Marichiaro. He was slapped brutally across the face. You are an aristocrat, and you probably live on a hill right here in Napoli. Who are you? It was a college initiation, Sigismundo improvised. I had to prove I could pass as a peasant. You are a police spy, Ayla Aswad pronounced, and a particularly stupid one. Does anybody think we should let this little defecation out of here alive? There was a long silence. At least it seemed long to Sigismundo. And then somebody said, Hell no, just to make it official, probably. Ayla Aswad held his dagger to Sigismundo's nose. We will give you 1 minute to pray, he said. I'm going to piss my pants, Sigismundo thought. They don't do that in opera. They just sing a brave aria and then die. Why didn't I listen to Uncle Pietro's warnings? Pray, you drunken imbecile, Ayla Aswad said passionately. You have only 30 seconds left. I am a Celine and a Malatesta. I will not pee myself. I surrender my soul to the mercy of Our Lady, Sigismundo said tightly, not allowing his voice to quiver, and I die a good servant of my God and our Holy Father the Pope. Everybody laughed. It was like the funniest climax in the most hilarious commedia that ever played a theater. They couldn't control themselves. They were slapping their thighs and practically falling over with mirth. Sigismundo could hardly believe his ears. How could even atheists like these wretches laugh at a brave boy's dying prayer? Jesus, Jesus, Ayla Aswad howled, bending over gurgling. Then they started to take off their hoods, one by one. Ayla Aswad was a silk merchant, a friend of Uncle Pietro's. And there was Father Ratti and Mr. Drake and Uncle Carlo, and then other merchants, and the last was Uncle Pietro himself. You are a hard boy to frighten, Uncle Pietro said. Damn you, Sigismundo cried, not caring that Father Ratti was there. But Drake stepped between Uncle Pietro and Sigismundo. It wasn't his idea, he said. It was mine. As soon as the guards at the palace told me your madcap idea, I knew you'd get yourself killed if we didn't teach you a lesson in reality first. Damn you, Sigismundo repeated, meaning all of them. Listen, Drake said. This is exactly what would have happened if you got anywhere near the Rossi, except the hoods wouldn't have come off at the end and you wouldn't be alive. If it hadn't been your hands, it would have been something else. You have no idea how many ways they have of detecting infiltrators. He's about to damn us all again, Father Ratti said gently. He was wrong. Sigismundo bolted for the door. He could no longer control his bowels. The relief of not dying was even more intense, physiologically, than the fear had been. They found him coming out of the jakes, trying to walk with dignity. Forgive us, Father Ratti said. There was no other way to stop you from getting yourself killed. Sigismundo ignored him. He walked boldly to Uncle Pietro and stared him in the eye, unflinching. Now I know why Cervantes was so funny to you, he said coldly with icy dignity. And he added with a quiet, restrained melancholy, At last he was free of the damnable books of romance. Very touching, Uncle Pietro said with equal coldness. You'd be more impressive, though, if you had remembered to button your fly. And Sigismundo did not sleep at all that night. But, once he was home, paced his room continually, thinking about the monstrous, monumental immensity of his own folly. Even though Voltaire was banned in Napoli, he knew one joke from the French cynic. The only way to understand what mathematicians mean by infinity is to contemplate the extent of human stupidity. Everything Father Ratti had said about humility was beginning to make sense. He had been a fool in San Francesco di Paola, attacking a frigging professional assassin without any awareness that the formalism of fencing class might not apply to men who really knew about murder. He had been a fool again the next day, almost killing an innocent child because he thought he knew everything, when he actually knew nothing about the real situation. And he had been a fool for the third and most shameful time, when he had imagined an agent of the secret police would actually send a flaming idiot like himself into a revolutionary meeting. Father Ratti had explained in religious knowledge class that true humility did not mean a sense of worthlessness or the kind of timidity that caused some people to be cheated and bullied all their lives. The virtue of humility, Ratti said, was merely the faculty of intelligence operating properly. The man of wisdom, Ratti explained once, fears only one man on earth. Do you know who that is?
and when everybody guessed wrong, some said the Pope, some said King Ferdinand, Ratti said, "The man of wisdom fears himself. He knows who it is who tells him the most plausible lies, the lies he wants to believe." So Sigismundo, thrice a fool, was determined to acquire humility and to catch himself if he tried to tell himself a lie. This was by no means easy. It was much simpler and very tempting to put on elaborate airs of abasement, like some of the Franciscans, or to grovel in a sense of enormous sinfulness, like the penitents who whip themselves in public, which could be a secret form of pride, Father Ratti said, or just to be slavishly submissive like a peasant. Real humility was more complicated. It was like walking around two steps behind yourself, watching everything you did. He went to the great cathedral of Naples on Via Duomo when the latest miracle was reported. He was sure some of God's grace would enter him that way. Of course, the miracle happened two or three times a year, and he had seen it before, but now, as he was seeking to put away childish things, in the apostles' words, it would have new meanings for him. San Gennaro had been beheaded in AD 302, and the cathedral held two vials of his dried blood, which most marvelously would come alive, liquefy again, whenever Napoli needed a reminder that their patron saint was still thinking of them. Next to the tomb of the great poet Virgil, the vials of the blood of St. Gennaro were the most stupendous things in Napoli, as everyone agreed. Even if some tourists were so ignorant that they looked only at the bay, and the paintings by Titian and San Domenico Maggiore, and the terracottas by Mazzoni and Santa Anna di Lombardi that were so real they made you jump. There were penitents at the cathedral, of course. They always turned out for a miracle, beating themselves with their whips and howling about their unforgivable inequities. There were also the usual peasants, kneeling for hours without moving. But they were probably not praying for enlightenment, Sigismundo thought. Such was beyond their childish, illiterate minds. They were probably just asking for the recovery of some sick infant, or maybe for the landlord not to raise the rent again. Still, such a mobile passion was awe-inspiring. It was almost as if their souls had left their bodies and gone directly to heaven to plead with God in person, while their fleshly parts remained here, frozen, like statues. And there were the usual gawking tourists. When the priests brought the vials from the Restituta, the old basilica dating from the 4th century, and carried them through the cathedral so all could see the red miracle, Sigismundo heard a disturbing thing. It was a Frenchman among the tourists, and he spoke softly to his companion and in German. Probably, he assumed, nobody in Napoli would have the mental energy to learn a non-Latin tongue. "Isn't it incredible," the Frenchman whispered, "that they can still pull off this hocus-pocus, and the arseholes believe in it?" Sigismundo closed his eyes and prayed to put down the sin of rage. Why, if the miracle were a fraud, that would mean that these devout, holy, and pious priests were cheats and charlatans. And not just these priests, but all the priests in the cathedral, all the way back to the ancient times when the miracle was first reported, centuries of deliberate deception that would be a Machiavellian conspiracy to delude men's minds, and, worse yet, a conspiracy that had succeeded for ages and ages. That was a monstrous, frightening thought. Still, Sigismundo had always been fascinated by the tricks of the improvisatore in the market, and had nagged Uncle Pietro until some of the basic principles of conjuring were explained. Only the principles. Uncle Pietro insisted that telling too much makes the intellect lazy. So Sigismundo had to apply the principles anew to each trick he saw, figuring out for himself how the magic was done. With guilty discomfort, he visualized how easy it would be to fake the miracle of the living blood of San Gennaro. There would be no art to it at all. The priests went alone to the Restituta. They could spill out the dried blood, add fresh blood from a stray cat even, who would know, and then march out with the vials to astonish everybody. The tricks of the improvisatore, performed in public with 1,000 eyes watching, were much more difficult. Of course, this terrible fantasy could not be true. Why, if it were true, then anything might be a trick or a lie. The world would be a madhouse of intrigue and deception, no man ever daring to trust another. Mother of God, if you couldn't trust the church, whom or what could you trust? Maybe San Gennaro never lived. Maybe this was a ritual of Janus disguised as Christianity.
Maybe Saint Gennaro was never beheaded by Diocletian. Maybe Diocletian was a lovely fellow and a barrel of laughs and never beheaded anyone. Maybe the Roman Empire never existed but was invented by storytellers. Maybe for Jesus' sake there was no France and some actors were hired to visit Napoli, occasionally speaking the alleged French language to keep up the pretense. Such thoughts were madness. You could end up unable to decide anything. There was a peasant in Posillipo, a mad fellow who claimed a flaming rock had fallen out of the sky into his field one night. You could think this cuckoo was right, and that all the most learned theological and scientific minds in Europe were involved in a gigantic conspiracy to hide the fact that such rocks did fall, just because rocks from the sky did not fit into either the Bible or Newton's theories. That was where total skepticism landed you, in the Selva Sciora of Dante, the endless labyrinth or philosophical spaghetti, as Uncle Pietro would say, in which men have been wandering since the unity of faith was shattered. Some things are for sure, and it is crazy to question them, Sigismundo reminded himself. Priests do not lie. Flaming rocks do not fall out of the sky. Mama was never unfaithful to Papa, and I am Sigismundo Cellini of Napoli, not the man in the moon. Having come to this conclusion, Sigismundo decided to say a prayer for the misguided Frenchman, hoping that God would shed grace upon him and bring him back to the light. It was time to pay a condolence call on Aunt Gina. He knew it and had been postponing it for days because at 14 he simply did not know how to deal with the grief of an adult. On a Wednesday in June, he forced himself to go. When he arrived at the old house where the Via di Roma crosses the volcanic Posillipo Ridge, he was still reminding himself not to think of it as Uncle Leonardo's house. It was Aunt Gina's house now, another sign that nothing would ever go back to the way it was before Easter. When old Bianca, the chief housemaid with the bouncing bosoms, showed him into the living room, he was shocked by Aunt Gina's face. She had always been renowned not just for her beauty, but for her taste. The room was decorated in pinks and cinnamons and siennas, rugs and drapes and divans and paintings all coordinated exquisitely, a loveliness as simple but splendid as the Parthenon by moonlight. It hurt the heart to see the ugly old woman, not yet 40, in widow's black, sitting amid such beauty she had once created. "Auntie," he said, "I want to say..." And then in horror he found that he was weeping, the dozen speeches he had rehearsed were all forgotten, and it wouldn't have mattered if all the boys in his fencing class were watching. He couldn't have controlled it even then, because it was an explosion from within. Even his nose was running, along with his eyes. He remembered that strange expression in Homer that Father Ratti said meant, literally, compassion exploded in his nose. "Don't snivel and whine. Don't snivel and whine." That was what he had been learning from boyhood on, how to stop being just the artist in the family, how to become a man. And now he was both sniveling and whining, whimpering even, and Aunt Gina was hugging him, and he was hugging her, and they wept together for what seemed like a long time. Finally, they stopped weeping and sat down. Old Bianca, who had probably expected the explosion of grief and had been listening for it to subside, entered unobtrusively and served tea. "Those men will be caught and punished," Sigismundo said, remembering his speech. "Uncle Pietro has many contacts." "I know," Aunt Gina said wanly, "but that will not be the end of it. It will never end, never, as long as I remember Leonardo. And there is worse now." But before she could explain that, Uncle Pietro himself appeared at the top of the stairs with a Dominican monk. From where he sat, Sigismundo could see that they were arguing, but in very low voices. As they came down the stairs, their voices became more audible. "I tell you, I know the signs," the Dominican was protesting in a sad, soulful whisper, like a waiter explaining how the dead mouse got into the cioppino. "You have tried 3 times and failed," Uncle Pietro whispered back. "It is time to try an alternative." But by now they were in the living room, and Uncle Pietro was composing his face. "Madam," he said formally to Aunt Gina, "Brother Eugenius has not yet succeeded. He wishes to summon a better-trained exorcist. In the meanwhile, I again propose that we see what medicine has to offer."
Any doctor will tell you at once that this is outside his ken, the monk said sullenly.
You may well be right, Uncle Pietro said smoothly. Summon your demon-conquering exorcist from Roma. Meanwhile, no harm can be done by trying a simpler approach.
Sigismundo was thoroughly confused.
He is my son, Aunt Gina said. We will try both ways. All I want is for poor Tony to be himself again.
You will just waste time and money, the monk said. I recognize the signs from many similar cases. This is demonic possession, I tell you.
Sigismundo felt a wave of horror move up his spine.
When Brother Eugenius finally left, still warning that doctors do not understand such cases, Uncle Pietro sat down on the burnt sienna divan with Aunt Gina and took her hand.
You know of my affection for you and your unfortunate son, he said. I beg you to trust my judgment.
Do you really think it is an illness? Aunt Gina asked timidly, as if afraid to entertain hope again.
I am convinced of it, Pietro said.
Then take him to your wise doctor, Aunt Gina said. Living with Tony the way he is now is worse than living with my grief.
When Antonio was called to the living room, Sigismundo was startled. His cousin looked paler than seemed possible for a Neapolitan, paler even than a Swede, and he smelled putrid.
Uncle Pietro has come to take you to a doctor, Aunt Gina said.
Antonio looked at Uncle Pietro absently, as if a million more important things were distracting him.
My mother is a whore, he said with no particular inflection.
Some noses are roses, he added thoughtfully.
You are upset and confused, Uncle Pietro said.
She became a whore to punish me, Antonio explained reasonably, because I murdered my father. He had a funny nose, too.
I am going to hell, Jesus says, but so is everybody else.
That is all nonsense, Pietro replied calmly. You are frightened and confused, and that is all.
Noses, 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 and pink roses, Antonio screamed suddenly, losing his detachment. You are another of the demons. Do you want to sodomize me too?
Sigismundo made the sign of the cross.
Aunt Gina sobbed again. You see, she said, can you imagine living with him day after day?
It is just an excitement of the senses caused by shock, Pietro said. It can be cured.
Nothing can be cured, Antonio said, suddenly drained of emotion again. The last judgment is coming. They will chop off our noses.
You have to go to Philadelphia, he added, turning abruptly to Sigismundo. Everybody goes to hell, but Siggy goes to Philadelphia.
As there is a God of all things, my mind is a complete blank.
But Uncle Pietro was not buying that line of merchandise, and, despite a good deal more of it along the way, he remained calm as he led Antonio to his doctor friend.
Sigismundo trailed along, perhaps for extra restraint if Tony got any wilder. Soon they were entering the Jewish ghetto.
Are you sure you know what you're doing? Sigismundo asked.
I know his talk sounds like the language of hell itself, Uncle Pietro said. It is merely the language of dreams. It is happening to him when he is awake only because of shock.
They had arrived at the shop of a chemist, called, according to the sign in the window, Abraham Orfali.
Pietro pushed open the door, and Sigismundo was overwhelmed by scents he could scarcely categorize. This Signor Orfali was better stocked than the average chemist.
Orfali came from behind a curtain as the bell over the door announced customers. He was white-bearded and almost dark enough to be a Moor, one of the Eastern Jews. Then Sigismundo noticed the old man's eyes. They were the eyes of one who penetrates everything he looks at, without surprise, without approval or contempt, with the detached absorption of a natural philosopher looking down a microscope.
Pietro, Orfali said with genuine affection.
Abraham, my friend, Uncle Pietro said.
As they shook hands, Sigismundo noticed that their fingers curled in a strange way.
You're another nose, Antonio remarked casually. And a sodomite, too.
He giggled childishly, but his eyes were like those of a family dog caught killing the chickens.
So? Orfali looked at Pietro inquiringly.
This is Dr. Orfali,
Pietro told Antonio sternly. You will address him with respect. He does not practice medicine because of certain prejudices in this community, but he is the only one in Napoli who can help you.
Nobody can help me, Antonio said dully. I killed my father, and there are crocodiles behind that curtain.
He's the one whose father was killed in the church? Dr. Orfali asked Pietro.
I see.
And this one? Pointing to Sigismundo.
Another nephew, one you may know well someday, Pietro said. Sigismundo Celline, Dr. Abraham Orfali.
What are you going to do to me? Antonio asked.
Brother Eugenius says they may need whips to drive the demons out.
I'm afraid of whips.
I do not think whips are what you need, Dr. Orfali said gently.
Come into the back room, and we will just talk a bit first.
Very well, Antonio said. I think the crocodiles have left, except their noses.
They went into a tiny room that seemed to be crammed with books, in Hebrew, in Latin, in Spanish, in Arabic, even in Greek.
Dr. Orfali had brought an herb jar from the front of the shop, and he began mixing powder with water.
Why did you kill your father? He asked. Was he a very bad man?
Because I am a terrible sinner. Jesus says Napoli isn't bad enough for me, and I must go to hell.
Oh, I see, Dr. Orfali said judiciously. I suppose you've been committing these loathsome sins for about a year now?
Antonio suddenly blushed. So did Sigismundo, vaguely understanding this.
Dr. Orfali was finished with his herbal mixture.
Please drink this, he said, as if it were a real favor to him.
As Antonio obeyed, the doctor said, Thank you, very warmly.
Then he added, I'm not really sure you murdered your father. Maybe you just imagined that because you have been excited and confused.
But I have committed horrible sins, Antonio said vehemently. I insult my mother and call her a whore. I don't know why. It is the devil inside me that takes over my nose. My nose.
He dropped the cup.
You are getting tired, the doctor said. I can understand that. You probably haven't slept well lately, yes?
I can hardly sleep at all, Antonio said. At night, the demons talk to me about hell and sodomy and things that will happen in the future. Terrible things.
What do the voices tell you about the future? The doctor asked curiously.
The last judgment is coming. Mobs will riot. Kings will die. Monasteries will be looted. Many will have their heads cut off in public. All Europe will be at war.
Pietro and Dr. Orfali exchanged glances.
You are more tired, Abraham Orfali said, very softly now. You can hardly keep your eyes open. Why don't you just rest for a while? The devils will not bother you here. I can see that your eyes are closing. You are safe here. With every word I speak and with every breath you take, the voices of the devils are going further away, fading away.
Antonio was now sound asleep.
Ato malkuth, vegabura, vegadula, le olam.
Abraham chanted, almost singing, looking upward passionately. Then he turned to Antonio again.
Please repeat after me, he said. Toward the one.
Toward the one, Antonio spoke in his sleep.
The perfection of love, harmony, and beauty.
The perfection of love, harmony, and beauty.
The only being.
The only being.
United with all those illuminated souls.
United with all those illuminated souls.
Who form the embodiment of the teacher.
Who form the embodiment of the teacher.
The spirit of guidance.
The spirit of guidance.
Good. Most excellent, the doctor said. Thank you.
Now, I am going to take you back in time to a day when you were in the botanical garden and the sun was very bright. It was a day when you were perfectly relaxed and very lazy. The sun was all over your body. You were wrapped in a cocoon of light. You can experience it again right now. The sun is very relaxing and all over your body.
Your feet are very warm from the sun. Your legs are very warm. You can feel it in your belly, and your arms are very warm. Your chest is very warm and very relaxed. The doctor went on talking about that sunny day in the garden. He spoke more and more slowly, enunciating each word carefully, coming back to the same phrases over and over, repeating warm and relaxed many times. Sigismundo almost started to drowse himself, even without the sleep herb Antonio had been given. "Now," Dr. Orfali said, "please take a deep breath, but very slowly. That's it. Inhale, inhale, inhale. Keep inhaling. Fill your chest with that warm sunlight. Feel your heart full of golden sunlight. Now, open your mouth and let it all out slowly as I count from 8 to 1. 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Very good. Thank you. Now, if you will look as far as you can see into the distance, you will notice a gigantic figure in a red robe. He is the great archangel Raphael, who executes the will of God. Speak his name. Raphael, Antonio said. Good, excellent. You are getting even more relaxed. Now behind you, there is another gigantic archangel in a blue robe. His name is Gabriel, and he communicates the wisdom of God. Speak his name. Gabriel. Good, very good. You are warm and relaxed now. And there is another archangel at your right, in a robe of glittering gold. His name is Michael, and he embodies the love of God. Speak his name. Michael. Now, you will notice another archangel at your left, in a leafy green robe. His name is Ariel, and he inhabits all the creations of God. Speak his name. Ariel. Now I'm going to count from 8 to 1 again, and you will become even more relaxed and go deeper and deeper, because you have nothing to fear here. The angels will always be with you now, and they will make a shield to keep the devil voices out. You will always be protected, and I am starting to count. There was a great deal more sunlight and relaxation and counting backward, and the angels kept returning with more details added at each appearance, until even Sigismundo, who hadn't been drugged, was beginning to recognize distinct personalities in each of them. And then Dr. Orfali was counting backward again, but at 1, he asked suddenly, "Who killed your father?" "I don't know. 4 strangers." "And you will remember it that way from now on," old Abraham said. "You will no longer be mixed up and think you did it yourself. With every breath you take, and with every word I utter, the voices of the devils are going further away, and the angels will always protect you. This is true, and you believe me, and you will be much relieved when you wake up, and day by day the voices will go further away, because every time you think they are starting again, you will just breathe and count backward from 8 to 1, and the angels will protect you. Now, you will rest for a few moments, but it will be like many hours, and when I wake you, you will feel as if you had a wonderful night's sleep, and you will feel very good all over, better than you've felt in years and years." Dr. Orfali beckoned Pietro to a corner. Sigismundo, not invited but not warned off, followed them. "Cases like this," Orfali said softly, "are the hardest of all. Despite what the donkeys and monkeys in the College of Medicine think, it is much easier to get rid of physical symptoms than these mental problems. You had better bring him back once a week for a while until I see signs of real transformation. Meanwhile, I can promise you that the improvement will be dramatic enough that his mother will not let the exorcists take their whips to the poor lad." "I understand," Pietro said.
With physical symptoms, you have only to treat one soul. In these cases, you have to deal with all three. Sigismundo decided they must be talking of the three souls described by Aristotle. I wish, Pietro began, but he did not even finish, seeing the look in old Abraham's eyes. You know it is forbidden, the old man said. Sigismundo realized that Pietro wanted to pay and that Abraham could not accept money because of an oath he had taken, and with that, he knew what Abraham was. FRC, he blurted out, unable to control himself, realizing that, just once in his life, he had to prove himself shrewder than Uncle Pietro realized. Two bland faces, revealing no more than a pair of locked doors, looked down at him. That was a good guess, Pietro said quietly. Considering certain Domini Canis, however, you would do well never to mention that subject again. Which was tantamount to a confession. Abraham Orfali was a very advanced member of the Fraternitas Rosae Crucis, the legendary Rosicrucians, the invisible college that knew all the forbidden arts and sciences, but lived in secrecy to avoid trouble with the authorities. Only the highest-ranking Freemasons, it was said, could even apply for membership in the FRC. They returned to Antonio. You will wake in a minute or so, feeling better than you have in years, the doctor repeated. Within 24 hours, you will decide that you haven't been getting enough exercise lately, and you will take up fencing or some other active sport, because now you have a lot of new energy. You will sleep well at nights because the angels will always protect you. Your father was killed by 4 strangers, and you will always remember that correctly after today. Now, when I count to 5, you will wake up. 1. And when Antonio woke up, he was in fact bright and cheerful again. When Sigismundo and Uncle Pietro walked home with him, however, he did make a few peculiar remarks, nothing as eerie as his earlier ramblings, but still somewhat bizarre. Isn't it strange that people think time flows in only one direction? He asked, and later he added, I know I've been confused, but Jesus was a woman when he came to me. After they left Antonio with Aunt Gina, both looking much improved, Sigismundo said to Uncle Pietro, I won't ask anything about the FRC, lowering his voice, but tell me about the three souls. Aristotle doesn't say you can use them to heal diseases. Pietro turned toward the Orto Botanico, obviously wanting some privacy for this conversation. Aristotle didn't know everything, he said quietly. Actually, there are potentially at least 8 souls. We are born with 1. But how many we develop is a matter of education and hard work and, to tell you the truth, luck. The 3 souls Aristotle knew about are just the average at this stage of human development. The FRC, lowering his voice further, is made up of men with at least 4 souls. They entered the botanical garden. The first soul is vegetative, as Aristotle said. It is the same in you and me and these plants. It feels terror when threatened, and happiness when it is fed or nourished, and that is about all it feels or knows. It is quite mechanical. Vico claimed it was the only soul in the most primitive men, the giants. I read that, Sigismundo said. Vico says the Cyclops in the Odyssey was one of these giants. He says they survive in the New World, and the Indians call them Bigfoot. I haven't been to the Americas, Uncle Pietro said, so I wouldn't know about that. The point is that this primitive soul, which you can observe easily in newborn infants, cannot speak and communicates in signs. According to FRC teaching, whispering again, all physical illness, without exception, is the sign language of this vegetative mind. The signs are saying, I am afraid, I feel helpless, I need mama. And so on. The doctors do not know this, so they bleed the victim or cut holes in him, and he gets worse and eventually dies. Dr. Orfali uses certain herbs to put the higher souls to sleep, and then speaks to this primitive infant soul and reassures it.
It is said that a magus must be male and female in one. That means he must become like a mother and speak as a mother to a frightened infant. You heard Abraham speaking that way, if you think about it.
Sigismundo digested this.
Then the animal soul, he said, is characteristic not just of beasts, but of the barbaric men, as Vico called them, the men who fight over territory, the Hercules type.
Exactly, but you must remember that we each contain that barbaric psyche, just as we contain the more primitive vegetative psyche. The human soul, the pure reason, comes in on top of all that and is often overruled by vegetative fears or barbaric angers. In fact, reason very seldom overrules these older parts of the mind. More generally, it perverts itself to find rationalizations to justify them. The vegetative and animal souls are very old and deep, and reason is very new and weak thus far. And what happens in the illness of the senses, such as Antonio has? That is a major civil war in the psyche. All three souls are equally confused by shock, and all are in conflict with each other. The cure may take a long time. It is very dangerous to talk of such things. If the Inquisition does not burn you at the stake for such ideas, the College of Medicine will plot your ruin in other ways.
What about the fourth soul? How many men have developed to that level?
Teaching too much, too fast, makes for confusion, Uncle Pietro said. Digest what I have already told you. Watch people and see which of the three souls are acting in them at that given moment. See which souls dominate which people most of the time. Study yourself to see which soul is strongest most of the time. Then you can begin looking around for signs of the fourth soul in some people.
But I warn you again, do not talk about such things in Napoli. The eyes and ears of the Inquisition are everywhere.
But Sigismundo was thinking, no wonder the Inquisitors are often excessive and sometimes completely unfair. They see conspiracies everywhere because, by God, there are conspiracies everywhere. In only a few months, I have learned of the Carbonari, who may or may not be the inner chiefs of Masonry, and the Jacobites, who may or may not be the Carbonari, and the Masons themselves, who may be anyone and everyone, including even a Jesuit like Father Ratti, and the Alumbrados, who may include the Rossi, unless it's the other way around, and the Rossi include the Alumbrados, and the Mafia, and now the FRC. We have more secret societies than a Juno has crabs, more than the Umbertos have florins out at interest, more than my poor head can comprehend.
Uncle Pietro guessed his thoughts.
It is always that way in conquered nations, he said sadly.
There was a piece by Scarlatti, a sonata in D major, that was like the human soul trying to free itself from the vegetative and animal souls. And Sigismundo was walking in the market, working on a variation, developing a series of chords that would carry the theme through a circular or solar permutation, like some of the old church music, to arrive back where it started in such a way that it would be going forward and backward at the same time. This was very amusing because the mathematics of it was so precise, almost like two Greeks haggling over a contract, and yet the sound would be in the gallant style, and you'd almost want to dance to it. And then Sigismundo saw Carlo Maldonado, resplendently rich in the magnificent brocade of that family, examining silks at a stall. You couldn't miss Carlo. His stockings were the same precise blue as his blouse. His cloak was woven with enough gold thread to make a hoard for a miser, and even in Napoli, where the nobles were not famous for drab or conservative dress, he was as unobtrusive as a unicorn. Sigismundo's steps faltered. Guilt and remorse gnawed at him as he thought, "There's the innocent boy I almost murdered. Because I didn't stop to think. Because I let the animal in me run wild. Because I was the Cyclops, as Vico would say, and not the Odysseus." But even as he started to turn, Sigismundo suddenly became conscious of many eyes around him,
They are not looking at me, he told himself quickly. But still, if he turned too suddenly, somebody might notice. Somebody might say the Malatestas were afraid to show their faces on the streets when they saw the Maldonados coming. Sigismundo walked forward, not looking at Carlo, walking past him rapidly, staring ahead as if at some goal he must reach in a hurry. And then he collided with a blonde man and was catapulted, slam-bang, open-mouthed as an idiot, right into Carlo's chest. Hey, Carlo cried, watch where you're going. Then he recognized Sigismundo. Oh, he said, a Malatesta. Has the wine finally ruined the brains of your whole family? Can't you even walk straight? Sigismundo's hand moved toward his sword hilt, but he stopped it midway. The rational human soul should govern the emotions of the animal soul. I am sorry, he said stiffly. It was an accident. But the blond man, who was very tall but dark of skin, half Sicilian and half northerner probably, was looming above both boys. I'm sorry, he repeated, mimicking Sigismundo. It was an accident. How effeminate the Malatestas have grown, he added sarcastically, addressing everybody within earshot. You stay out of this, Sigismundo said sharply. It's none of your business. But his ears were reddening. He wasn't sure he did not look like a coward to some of the crowd. Carlo, only 12 after all, was beginning to see the possibilities of emerging as a real hero and thoroughly humiliating a Malatesta. Yes, stay out of this, he lisped, in the same caricature of Sigismundo's tone, making it sound girlish. Sigismundo considered. You know, he said to Carlo, if my dog had a nose like yours, I'd shave his rump and teach him to walk backward. The crowd was bigger and louder now. You tell him, Sigismundo, somebody shouted. Carlo flushed. The only sheep in Napoli who are still virgins are the ones who can run faster than you, he said. There was a satisfactory roar of laughter. You tell him, Carlo, somebody shouted. I wonder, Sigismundo said, does Count Maldonado have any idea who your real father is? Or was the list of suspects too long? The laughter was louder. Everybody thought this was turning into a great entertainment. Maybe we should add juggling and trapeze and then take up a collection, Sigismundo thought. Then Carlo bit his thumbnail. The laughter stopped. Sigismundo sighed. Don't draw your sword, he said. You might cut your dork off. That did it. Carlo had his sword out in a second. Take back what you just said about my mother, he demanded, his voice shrill. He's afraid of me, Sigismundo thought, but he's more afraid of backing down in public. Thus cowardice doth make courage for us all, as Uncle Pietro would say. Carlo's sword was pointing nowhere yet, not in the challenge position exactly. Take it back, he repeated. I meant no offense, Sigismundo said stiffly. It was just banter. I thought we were just teasing each other. Carlo decided this was weakness. Take it back, he repeated, now raising his sword to challenge position. How do you get free of the damnable books of romance when everybody else is still living in them? Listen, Sigismundo said, I don't want to hurt you. Two little girls, the blonde man said mockingly, each one afraid of the other. Sigismundo's sword was in his hand at once. Stop and think, he was telling himself, but the sword was already a challenge. It was another freeze, just like the horror in San Francesco di Paola on Easter, for it seemed an eternity as he slowly moved his sword to tip Carlo's, making the challenge official. Moira. I almost killed him once, through stupidity, and I escaped by luck, and now here I am playing the same scene again. Uncle Pietro is right. He says destiny is the name we give our bad habits when we realize they cannot be changed. The brave fools die first, said a familiar voice in a tone of withering contempt. Everyone turned as old Tanone pushed to the center of the crowd. What heroic children, Tanone said loudly.
ready to die right now, just over a few stupid words. And what fine citizens we have here, egging these children on, just to see some fresh blood again. What, are you all bored? Has it been a few weeks since the last murder? You, sir, picking a fat fruit merchant out of the crowd. If you are really in need of excitement, how would you like to exchange a few thrusts with me? Now wait a minute, the merchant said. You're a professional. What? Tanoni cried. Are you afraid? What kind of Neapolitan are you? Do you lack testicles, my man, or is there shit in your blood? Stop bullying, the merchant stammered. Everybody knows you're invulnerable. Well, then, who does want to fight? Tanoni demanded. I'm waiting, he said coldly. The crowd began to disperse. You two simpletons, Tanoni said then. Sigismundo and Carlo both blushed. Go home and tell your mothers you almost gave them a new funeral to celebrate. Go, or I'll give you both a kick where it won't blind you. But as Carlo slunk away in one direction and Sigismundo in another, Sigismundo suddenly realized that the tall blonde man had vanished very rapidly as soon as the swords were drawn. He pushed me into Carlo, Sigismundo thought, and he incited us to fight. Arroso? Wheels within wheels, as Drake said. Sigismundo felt himself in the middle of a world where nothing was ever quite what it seemed, where treachery and conspiracy were as omnipresent as the wine of the professional beggars. Moira, a knot, a predetermined thing.